Show. Head on with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head on with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Welcome, welcome, one and all, to the Tuesday night edition, Tuesday afternoon, Tuesday evening, Tuesday morning, Tuesday lunchish, Tuesday somewhere on the planet, and possibly Wednesday edition of The Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid, this global broadcast, heading out in the ongoing effort to keep something approaching liberal media alive in the United States. Nobody does it quite like The Horn, do they? I don't think so. No, this is Conversation Radio for a Tuesday, and I'm awfully tickled to have you all around and about and on board and ready for 3 hours of cussing and discussing, as John says in the intro there. Now, we've got, as usual, for a Tuesday, we have a little bit of catching up to do. We have, in fact, some holdovers from Moran Monday, maybe a couple of extra nominees, and news in its own right for the afternoon itself. Where to start? It's always a bit of a conundrum as to just what is going to set the tone just right for an evening's programming, or an afternoon's, or Wednesday morning's. You know how it goes. I don't have to go through all the time. Gee whiz. Let's see. Yeah, I've got my brackets down. Come on. The Mountaineers are a 2 seed. You know. I've got them winning the whole thing. It would be disloyal not, you know, that kind of reality where they lose to Kentucky or God knows Missouri or Clemson or something like that. Can't do that. And you probably couldn't care less. We closed the discussion last night with a conversation about Tiger Woods, and lo and behold, I went to just see what was going on Espen earlier today, and, well, damn, it had been retransformed into the Tiger Woods Network. Apparently, huddled somewhere in a secure, undisclosed location, he and Ari Fleischer have decided that he will return to golf at the Masters. I think this is fraught with peril. But I don't know. Maybe it was the fact that ESPN's running ads that don't include video images of Tiger that kind of made Tiger go, wait a minute, what am I, chopped liver? I'm coming back at the Masters. Yeah, I know. For 99% of you, that who cares? And me too. Me too. It's a media thing more than it is a Tiger thing. The idea that ESPN just suddenly couldn't find any video footage of Tiger Woods putting on a green jacket and left him out of the video promos. Somehow I'm just not exactly buying into it. That's just silliness. That's not where we start the program, okay? This is just process. Not going to start with Tiger. Not going to start with the hoops. No. We're going to start with something that is probably, Tuesday's one of those days that doesn't, we haven't named it yet. We got Moran Monday, we got prayer meeting Wednesday, we got Friday on the front porch. Tuesday and Thursday just sort of sit there lonely and sort of needy, and we just do a regular show without, they don't have titles. So I guess we could just call them grab bags or something. But, it's all conversation radio. This is all driven as much by you as it is by me. You're the ones who contribute to keep the horn on the air. Therefore, you have a stake in what the programs are and what the content is. We don't deliver programming to you so as to introduce the commercial messages to you in hopes of BSing you into going out and buying a new kind of deodorant because, well, you stink. No, that's not the style of the horn. This truly is driven by you. You determine what you want liberal media, so to speak, to be. And that's why you bring topics to the table. I bring topics to the table. We discuss them. We process on them. We have a little fun. And we get kind of serious from time to time. This is about you and our joint effort to provide something besides the monotonous drone of the for-profit media. One of the things that when I think of the for-profit, the monotonous drone of the for-profit media, of late, one of the things that comes to mind is this op-ed from Howell Raines. Did you see this? It was published in the Washington Post. I was alerted to it by our dear friend and colleague, Dr. Bill O'Brien. And this is a good starting place. This makes perfect sense. Howell Raines, you know, is the former editor of the New York Times, right? And what's more, he's an Alabama boy, like me. Southern man. Southern. And he had this op-ed piece that bears sharing, really. This op-ed piece in Sunday's Washington Post. And this is a perfect jumping-off place for tonight's program, I think. Now, bear in mind, who was Howell Raines? Howell Raines was running the New York Times at the time when Judy Miller was serving as stenographer. And correct me if I don't have my timeline right, but I think Howell Raines was at the helm of the New York Times at the time when Judy Miller was doing her stenography for Dick Cheney in the run-up to the Iraq War. Howell Raines was editor of the New York Times when it was home on the range for the Bush administration, and where never was heard a discouraging word, and the skies were not cloudy all day. In terms of cheerleading the invasion of a poor, beleaguered, bedraggled, beaten-down nation that had done nothing to us. Howell Raines was right there in the middle of all of that. Doing every bit, you know, backgrounding every bit as much cheerleading as anyone in the nation. Remember, it was the New York Times that sat on data that could have been crucial to the United States about the lies that led up to the war, right? And they sat on it. Because, you know, you and I, we're not sharp enough to process information like that. Truly, it was elitism of a particularly noxious, stinking sort. And so, yeah, I don't know. It didn't sit well on my belly. It was like, I don't know, it was like eating something that wasn't quite right. This headline and this op-ed piece from the 14th of March in the Washington Post. Headline, why don't honest journalists take on Roger Ailes and Fox News? Well, my pink little ears just perked right up the minute what? A little bit bug in the eye. What? By Howell Raines. One question has tugged at my professional conscience throughout the year-long congressional debate over health care reform, and it has nothing to do with the public option, portability, or medical malpractice. It is this. Why haven't America's old-school news organizations blown the whistle on Roger Ailes, chief of Fox News, for using the network to conduct a propaganda campaign against the Obama administration A campaign without precedent in our modern political history? Okay, you know what? I can live with the biggest... That's a fair question. Why have professional journalists not called out Fox? Why has calling out Fox been left to Jon Stewart, Stephen Colbert, folks like Mike Malloy, myself, and a handful of people who recognize bad journalism, who know propaganda when they see it, but don't necessarily have the multi-million reach of so-called professional media? Why not? That paragraph gave me a chill, because it is as if some sort of, I don't know, maybe Howell Raines was passing through Pascagoula, Mississippi one evening and was picked up by a UFO spaceship and anal probed for a little while until his memory of the entire first decade of the 21st century just fizzled, gone. Because you cannot answer that question, Howell Raines, without engaging in a little bit of navel-gazing of your own. Because, you see, every news organization in this country, and this is a fitting and proper topic given the time of year, sweet Jesus, it is now 7 years. 7 years. Over 5,000 American lives, over 1 million Iraqi civilian lives, babies without daddies, children without mommies, nephews without uncles and aunts, aunts and uncles and cousins without cousins and nephews and nieces. Shattered families from lives gone, and lives unalterably transferred into a realm of hell and fear and misery for those who have returned alive but shattered from that miserable nightmare in the sand. 7 years of this agony. 7 years. There are children who will enter the third grade this coming fall who have never known a nation that was not at war. Let that settle in. What does that do to the psyche of a child? Because children are not... just passive participants in a family's life. They are not deaf to what goes on around them. The 7-year-olds in the United States of America have never known a moment's peace. I fear if you dwell on that for very long, you, like me, will be tempted to just simply break down in unconstrained weeping. Seven-year-olds. But that is... That's the American reality. Now, the question becomes one of, why? Well, Howell Raines, unless I'm getting it completely dead wrong, Howell Raines had a hand in it. Because Howell Raines wouldn't allow criticism of the war, wouldn't allow a legitimate analysis of why that war happened onto the pages of the New York Times. He, like every other professional for-profit media outlet in this country, was rah-rahing the Iraq War as hard and loudly as he could. Long before the arrival of Keith Olbermann or Rachel Maddow onto MSNBC, there was Phil Donahue, and he was run right off the air by MSNBC because no one was allowed to question dim leaders' reasoning for attacking a nation that had done nothing to us. So I think that question posed by Howell Raines in the opening paragraph of this article is a loaded one. Why haven't America's old-school news organizations blown the whistle on Roger Ailes, chief of Fox News, for using the network to conduct a propaganda campaign against the Obama administration, a campaign without precedent in our modern political history? Well, the answer to that, Howell Raines, is because America's old-school news organizations didn't blow the whistle on the Bush administration when it started the war in Iraq, and instead actively empowered it. What's the word for someone who isn't the addict but makes it possible for the addict to go on engaging in addict behavior? What's the word for enabler? Enabler. The Washington Post, the New York Times, CNN, MSNBC, CNBC, ABC, CBS, NBC, every paper in this country, virtually, every for-profit media outlet in this country, was actively engaged in covering not the realities of why we were going to war with Iraq, but the press releases being written out of the hellish bowels of the Bush administration's the press apparatus. Judy Miller was nothing more than a stenographer. And when the Bush administration talked about curveball, the New York Times was there to give curveball or screwball or spitball or split-fingered fastball or what the hell ever legitimacy. When Valerie Plame was outed, America's old-school news organizations were useless. Because had real journalism been done in the run-up to the Iraq War, if it had happened at all, would have been much more limited. And it's possible would not have happened at all. The greatest example in the last 50 years of the failure of professional journalistic organizations to uphold and safeguard their status as the guardians of the Fourth Estate lies in the run-up to the Iraq War and its subsequent ballyhooing. And because they did not challenge Fox could have been left out there to rah-rah the war all by themselves, with the possible exception of the Washington Times, if any member of the professional for-profit media had simply chosen to follow the tenets of their profession instead of their natural inclination to roll over and be scratched on the belly by the Bush administration. And for that, as I said, we have paid in blood and treasure almost innumerable and uncountable. So that's what made Howell Raines a little bit tough to stomach. But he continues. through clever use of the Fox News Channel and its cadre of raucous commentators, Ailes has overturned standards of fairness and objectivity that have guided American print and broadcast journalists since World War II, with the possible exception of the Iraq War. But Howell can't be brought to say that because that would be a self-indicting statement. That would be self-incriminating. Yet, many members of my profession seem to stand by in silence as Ailes tears up the rulebook that served this country well as we covered the major stories of the past three generations, from the Civil Rights Revolution to Watergate to the Wall Street scandals. Huh? Granted, some did. I remember once upon a time, boys and girls, and those of you very much at all younger than me will not remember, there was a guy in Washington named Jack Anderson. And Jack Anderson, do I remember the name right? Jack Anderson went hammer and tongs at the Nixon administration day in and day out to the point that he was way up on the official Nixon enemies list. Jack Anderson. He was called, and those of you older than me will remember this because we used to have a bunch of them. He was called an investigative reporter. And he sniffed things out, and he pursued things, and he reported facts in the face of intimidation, and didn't want his belly scratched by any particular administration. He was happy being what he was. Jack Anderson has been replaced by Anderson Cooper in some sort of sad and sorry game of 7 degrees of what used to be journalism. You know, Greg Palast is out there. Greg Palast does good investigative journalism. When's the last time you read Greg Palast on the pages of the Washington Post or the New York Times? Right. Robert Perry, ConsortiumNews.com. Bob Perry did that kind of investigative journalism until he got run out of the craft and had to go out and start the ConsortiumNews.com on the internet and start hustling for all he was worth just to keep beans on the tin plate on his table. There was a time, brothers and sisters, when we did have journalism in this country. Howell Raines refers to it in paragraph 2 and goes on to say, this is not a liberal versus conservative issue. It's a matter of Fox turning reality on its head with, among other tactics, its endless repetition of its Uber lie. The American people do not want health care reform. Do you begin to understand why this thing was harder and harder and harder for me to get through? Because, see, I remember some other Uber lies. Oh, let's see if I can just come up with one off the top of my head. We don't want the smoking gun to be a mushroom cloud. Iraq has obtained yellow cake uranium ore from Niger. That was one. My friend, let's see, can I remember this close enough that it's almost to quote it? Well, it's paraphrasing, but it's new. My friends, these are not theories. These are facts. These photos you see prove that Saddam Hussein is pursuing weapons of mass destruction. General Colin Powell, Secretary of State to the United Nations, long about late 2002. Sound about right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Uber lies. And they weren't just pushed by Roger Ailes and Fox News. They were hustled along, and its little butt was patted by Howell Raines, too. Now you just get on out there, sweetheart. And that lie was called, "The American People Must Make War on Iraq." So to go back, he writes, "It is a matter of Fox turning reality on its head with, among other tactics, its endless repetition of its uber lie, the American people do not want health care reform. Fox repeats this as gospel. But as a matter of historical context, usually in short supply on Fox News, this assertion ranks somewhere between debatable and untrue. So too did the New York Times under Howell Raines' assertions that war was all but unavoidable with Iraq because of Iraq's failure to prove a negative, which anyone with half a brain understands can't be done. Mr. Raines constrains himself to the issue of health care reform and how it is that that Fox has mobilized to attempt to keep that from taking place. I cannot do that because and this is not an attack on Howell Raines. This is not an ad hominem attack. I hope that it is not coming across in that fashion. No. This is an attack on the hypocrisy of bleating about Fox News being untrue and pretending as if the New York Times wasn't suffering from the same problem as well. This is my complaint about Howell Raines reaching out to pluck the mote from Fox's eye without being aware of the beam in that of his own. For that is surely what he is doing. Now, this was, of course, at the same time when the New York Times, if it so much as published the name Al Gore, would be, someone would trot out Bernie Goldberg, just, liberal media, threat against America, die! You remember that time, don't you? I do. And the New York Times and the Washington Post and all the other for-profit, so-called professional, old-school journalistic enterprises lived, as they live still, in constant fear of being called liberal. Yeah. We lived through that. We still live with it, don't we? He goes on and says, "The American people and many of our great presidents have been demanding major reforms to the health care system since the administration of Teddy Roosevelt. The elections of 1948, 1960, 64, 2000, and 2008 confirmed the point, with majorities voting for candidates supporting such change. Yet congressional Republicans have managed effective campaigns against health care changes favored variously by Presidents Truman, Kennedy, Johnson, Nixon, and Clinton. Now Fox News has given the party of Lincoln a free ride with its repetition of the unexamined claim that today's Republican leadership really does want to overhaul health care if only the effort could conform to Mitch McConnell's ideas on portability and tort reform." Of God, this is like Jack and the Beanstalk, realizing that those really are just beans, and there ain't going to be no giant vine growing up into the clouds, and there ain't no golden goose laying no golden eggs. They's just beans. I mean, this is a hell of a time. I mean, I'm proud of him for noticing it, I guess. But this is a hell of a time for Howell Raines to suddenly look up and notice that there's problems with the Fourth Estate. Is it a matter of him merely having been unable to notice them while he was engaged in it? Fox News has given the party of Lincoln a free ride with its repetition of the unexamined claim that today's Republican leadership really does want to overhaul health care, if only that effort could conform to Mitch McConnell's ideas on portability and tort reform. To be fair, why is it that Howell Raines is directing this, again, only at Fox News? What is it that separates Fox News from the Chicago Tribune? Or the Birmingham News? Or the New York Times? Or the Washington Post? Baltimore Sun? Miami Herald? Atlanta Journal-Constitution, because at one time or another, every major news outlet in this country has legitimized by the Just Say No, Repig Lickin' Right, legitimized them by treating them as if they were offering a serious debate on policy. For all have sinned and come short of the glory of God, brethren and sistren, with all due respects to what we got to do tomorrow night. All of them have done it. To suggest that Fox News would be the worst practitioner of it, or the most profound practitioner of it, that I got and have no beef with. But to stand back with his little linen gloves on and say, "Oh no, there are no smudges on our fingertips," that's BS, baby. Without a doubt, that's BS. Pure, unmitigated, stinky, right there in the middle of the pasture. He continues. It is true that after 14 months of Fox's relentless pounding of President Obama's idea of sweeping reform, the latest Gallup poll shows opinion running 48-45 against the current legislation. Okay, let's talk about that for a minute, because Howell didn't do what Howell should have done here. Yes, that's what the opinion polls show, but the opinion polls don't break out that 48-45% against into what it is the 48% are against, because, yes, some significant portion of that 48%, probably a full 20-25% of that opposition, are birthers, baggers, deathers, tenthers, and various and sundry assorted booger eaters. Okay? Just are. But there is also a statistically significant portion of that statistical group that is comprised of people who are not happy with the legislation because of how weak it yet remains. Because it does not have a robust public option in it. Because it is not single-payer health care for all. And I would submit that there is a big difference within those two camps. The birthers, deathers, tenthers, baggers, and booger eaters being morons who are gladly serving as cannon fodder to their masters in the culture war. And those who are opposing it because it looks like it is corporate welfare giveaway, because it does not have a public option, and because there's no, the idea of single payer is, you know, long gone. Big difference between those two. But anyway, Mr. Raines says Fox invariably stresses such recent dips, he says dips. Sometimes that's at a distance. I got to get glasses, you see. I think I need the bifocals because I can't tell the difference between a CL and a D. Dips in support for the legislation, disregarding the majorities in favor of various individual aspects of the reform effort. Oh, look, he just said what I took a lot longer to say. Along the way, the network has sold a falsified image of the professional standards that developed in American newsrooms and university journalism departments in the last half of the 20th century. Well, bust my buttons, Colonel Raines. Whatever its shortcomings, journalism under those standards aspired to produce an honest account of social, economic, and political events. It bore witness to a world of dynamic change, as opposed to the world of foxy and reality. Really? How much did reality come into play in Judy Miller's reporting for the New York Times? Just asking. Well, let's see. We'll be greeted as liberators. The Iraq War will pay for Iraqi oil will pay for the Iraq War. Oh, God, they're too numerous to mention. Yellowcake, uranium, smoking, guns, mushroom, clouds. All the way back to, we never had
any idea that they would use airplanes as missiles.
And the New York Times had nothing to do with any of that? I was reading an alternate universe New York Times? Really? Okay. The world of foxy and reality, whose actors are brought on camera to illustrate a preconceived universe as rigid as that of medieval morality. Well, well, Hal Raines. Now, it is precisely our long-held norms that crippled our ability to confront Fox journalism's of perpetual assault, huh? Now, it is precisely our long-held norms that cripple our ability to confront Fox's journalism of perpetual assault. Oh, I see. Journalism of perpetual assault is a term of art, I suppose. See, that's how Howell Raines got to be editor of the New York Times. He uses fancy phrases like journalism of perpetual assault, whereas, you know, redneck like me, I just say Fox is bullshit. Yeah. I'm confident that many old schoolers are too principled to appear on the network, choosing silence over being used. When Fox does trot out a house liberal as a punching bag, the result is a parody of reasoned news formats. I'm confident that many old schoolers are too principled to appear on the network, choosing silence over being used. When Fox does trot out a house liberal as a punching bag, the result is a parody of reasoned news formats. I ran into somebody at the Progressive Media Summit who is very, very proud of having had several appearances now as the house liberal for Bill O'Reilly. I had nothing to offer in hearing that. Hal Raines does. When Fox does trot out a house liberal as a punching bag, the result is a parody of reasoned news formats. My great fear, however, is that some journalists of my generation, who once prided themselves on blowing whistles and afflicting the comfortable, look there. Time out. Excuse me, Mr. Raines? Mr. Howell Raines? Would you include yourself in that little moment of Fox style book writing? Some journalists. See, the use of the word some has been magnified by massive proportions in the era since Fox became a viable TV box enterprise, because it ain't news and it ain't journalism. Some journalists of my generation who once prided themselves on blowing whistles and afflicting the comfortable have also been intimidated by Fox's financial power and expanding audience, as well as Ailes' proven willingness to dismantle the reputation of anyone who crosses him. Is buried way deep inside this op-ed piece, is that Howell Raines trying to quietly explain why he himself didn't do it while he was editor at the New York Times? Is this the buried mea culpa of this op-ed piece? Remember his ridiculing one early anchor, Paula Zahn, as inferior to a dead raccoon in ratings potential when she dared defect to CNN? Apparently, Howell Raines does remember Roger Ailes referring to Paula Zahn as inferior to a dead raccoon. Well, I'm wondering if maybe some time on the couch is called for Mr. Raines with a qualified therapist. Rick Goodner, horn psychotherapist, what do you think? Did you hear this? It's as if we have surrendered the sword of verifiable. There we go. Yeah, it's bifocals time. Sorry. It's as if we have surrendered the sword of verifiable reportage and bought the idea that only elites are interested in information free of partisan poppycock. Oh, my goodness, Howell Raines is really pouring it on now. It's poppycock. He's hauled out the poppycock. Poppycock, sir, I say it's poppycock. Now, hold on here. Let me get my glove out and slap you across the cheek. Better watch out or I'll take over a federal fort and shell you or something. I am a southerner, after all, by God. That part I say with tongue in cheek, and because I are a southerner too. Oh, by the way, I almost forgot to mention, and this just fits in right nicely. We'll get right back to Howell in a second. I had a note from our buddy David in South Carolina earlier today. A real screamer. I don't mean David. I mean the story. Guess what? It turns out that the South Carolina legislature, no, museum, I'm sorry, not a legislature, the museum. South Carolina museum is considering whether to erect, well, there they go again, is considering whether to erect a monument to the state's secession from the Union almost 150 years ago. Now, that too is real, that's real live journalism from the state of South Carolina. A South Carolina museum is considering whether to erect a monument to the state's secession from the Union almost 150 years ago. Are they going to go back in time to erect the monument? Oh, I see. That refers to the secession from the Union almost 150 years ago. See, I wasn't clear. The board of the Patriots Point Development Authority considers on Tuesday, that would be today, whether to allow the Sons of Confederate Veterans to place an 11.5-foot granite monument to the ordnance signers at the Patriots Point Naval and Maritime Museum. The monument would have the name of each of the 170 signers and the wording of the secession document. Patriots Point in Charleston Harbor is a very special, hallowed place. Back in the 70s, my father's beloved USS Essex, and he wept at the news of it, was rendered scrap. And for all we know, may have wound up in a bridge or a can of Campbell's soup. But little portions of that warship, that fighting a ship in the fleet, as she was called, CV-9. Little portions were preserved and were enshrined aboard USS Yorktown, her sister ship, in the Essex class. And the USS Yorktown, lies at anchor, a permanent museum at Patriots Point in Charleston Harbor in South Carolina. Men from the North and the South, the East and the West, served honorably aboard both the Essex and the USS Yorktown. Men both black and white and Hispanic and Asian eventually served honorably aboard both ships. And it is absolutely beyond me, save for that essential character flaw of the Southern mindset, it is entirely beyond me why anyone would want to pollute the service of those heroes that is noted aboard that ship at that complex at Patriots Point. Why anyone would want to pollute that with reference to a bunch of racist, disgusting, elitist, plantation managing, slave owning secessionists. Because that's what that would be. It would be a complete disgrace to everyone honored at Patriots Point to put this museum, this monument, so to speak, 11.5 feet of granite, with the names of 170 racists, 170 secessionists, 170 anti-American thugs who would lead hundreds of thousands to their doom, to enshrine them at a place where the memories of real patriots reside? Oh, hell no. Oh, hell no. Oh, hell no. But it's South Carolina, and they probably gonna do it. And it sickens me. And it would be damn nigh enough to get my poor father up out of the dirt. But that's the way it is with the South. We lionize that moment of profound stupidity in the South. We write about it. We wallow in it. We know the history. And we say things like, well, you know, if Longstreet hadn't drug his heels at Gettysburg, it might have all been different. Or if only that Tar Heel sumbitch hadn't shot General Jackson, why, Gettysburg would have been a foregone conclusion because we'd have whooped ass and marched on to Washington and flanked them blue-belly bastards. Southerners are like that, if you didn't know. But really. So, that little diversion, but it ties in nicely with that idea that Howell Raines is, you can tell he's incensed when he says things like partisan poppycock. That's the way a fine old plantation southern man. Poppycock, good sir, poppycock, I tell you. Pure and unadulterated poppycock. I imagine they still say poppycock down in the Alabama State Legislature at Montgomery. Rumpf! But then he asks, Howell Raines does, why has our profession, through its general silence, or only spasmodic protest, yet no spasms coming from you, Howell, back in the Judy Miller days, if I recall correctly, help Fox legitimize a style of journalism? You mean like when you write things like some journalists? some journalists of my generation who once prided themselves, helped legitimize a style of journalism that is dishonest in its intellectual process, untrustworthy in its conclusion, and biased in its gestalt. Hoo-wee! Howell's hot! Done hauled out the gestalt! The standard answer is economics, as represented by the collapse of print newspapers and of audience share at CBS, NBC, and ABC. Some prominent print journalists are now cheering Rupert Murdoch, the head of News Corp, which owns the Fox Network, for his alleged commitment to print, as evidenced by his willingness to lose money on the New York Post and gamble the overall profitability of his company on the survival of the Wall Street Journal. This is like congratulating museums for preserving antique masterpieces while ignoring their predatory methods of collecting. I suppose that last sentence was meant for those above us who, you know, collect art and stuff, but don't pay any attention to where it came from. Why, look here. My dear Mabel, look here. Look here. Do you see this pot? Do you know it is 3,000 years old and came out of a riverbank and was isn't it a magnificent specimen of Native American pot making? Why, it is, it is. Where did you get it? I bought it from a dealer on the Lower East Side. Where did he get it? Well, we aren't asking any questions. That kind of thing. You and I can't do that. Why can't American journalists, he asks, steeped in the traditional values of their profession, be loud and candid about the fact that Murdoch does not belong on our team? Our team? Our team? Oh, my. Does he have the fraternity key? Has he ridden the goat yet? He hasn't been initiated. Oh, my God. His importation of the loose rules of British tabloid journalism, including blatant political alliances, started our slide to quasi-news. His British papers famously promoted Margaret Thatcher's political career with the expectation that she would open the nation's airwaves to Murdoch's cable channels. Ed Koch once told me he could not have been elected mayor of New York without the boosterism of the New York Post. Wow. From Margaret Thatcher to Ed Koch in the short space of less than 50 words? Wow. As for Fox's campaign against the Obama administration, perhaps the only traditional network star to put Ailes on the spot, at least a little, has been his friend, the venerable Barbara Walters. See, when you get to be about 1,000 years old like Barbara is, you get words like venerable instead of beautiful or alluring. Venerable. Worthy of worship. Appears to be made of stone. Who was hosting this week ABC's Sunday morning talk show. More accurately, she allowed another guest, Arianna Huffington, to belabor Ailes recently about his biased coverage of Obama. Ailes countered that he should be judged as a producer of ratings rather than a journalist. Audience is his only yardstick. While true as far as it goes, this hair-splitting defense purports to absolve Ailes of responsibility for creating a news department whose raison d'etre is to dictate the outcome of our nation's political discourse. See, Raines just fell into his own trap because he referred to it as a news department. That's the thing. What happens at Fox isn't news. It is opinion, pure and simple. Some may be more or less blatantly so, but opinion is the driving force that runs throughout Fox News. Not who, what, when, where, why, how, and how much journalism. This continues at great length. Until he concludes. Well, there's mention of Glenn Beck, which in large part is why I even addressed this issue. Fox has, in under the pretense of correcting a democratic bias in news reporting, Fox has accomplished something that seemed impossible before.
before Ailes imported to the news studio the tricks he learned in Richard Nixon's campaign think tank. He and his video ferrets have intimidated center-right and center-left journalists into suppressing conclusions. He could, Howell Raines could have added parenthetically, just as I allowed the Bush administration White House to intimidate the New York Times into suppressing any real journalism about the run-up to the Iraq War, close paren, whether on health care reform or other issues. They once would have stated, as demonstrably proven by the reporting, I try not to believe that this kid glove's handling amounts to self-censorship. But it's hard to ignore the evidence. News Corp, with 64,000 employees worldwide, receives the tender treatment accorded a future employer. Wrong word, Howell. Tender treatment accorded a future owner. In defending Glenn Beck on ABC, Ailes described him as something like Fox's political id rather than its whole personality. It is somehow fitting, then, that Sigmund Freud's great-grandson, Matthew Freud, might help put mainstream American journalism back in touch with its collective superego. Oh, well, we are terribly, terribly impressed with Howell Raines' vast wellspring of knowledge, aren't we? This year, Freud, a public relations executive in London, well, no irony in that, the great-grandson of Sigmund Freud went into PR. It all makes sense now. And Murdoch's son-in-law condemned Ailes in an interview with the New York Times, saying he was, quote, ashamed and sickened by Roger Ailes' horrendous and sustained disregard of proper journalistic standards. Meanwhile, damn! Has it not dawned on any of these people? And I know it's dawned on you, so I hope you'll just bear with me. I hope you haven't just tuned out at this 57-minute filibobster. But has it occurred on any of these lark's vomit canape, hummingbird tongue, lady finger eating, cocktail party crowd set, has it dawned on any of them that the goal of Fox News was never to do news? It's just a brand name. It's, have you ever seen a Twinkie twink? It's just a brand name. There are no kings in King Vitaman breakfast cereal. It's just a brand name. There's nothing lucky about Lucky Charms. It's just a brand name. And Fox News is just a brand name. Why is this so obvious to you and to me, and it's lost on the people who sit around with glass? We always carry our Chablis glass in our left hand in case we have to pat an old boy from the club on the shoulder or shake the delicate and rather transparent, rather vellum-like hand of his aging doyen of a wife. Because, you know, we know how to act. They know which fork to use for the shrimp, but they don't understand the basic principles of marketing? It's a brand name! But it hasn't dawned on them. It really hasn't. There's no news involved. There's no news in News Corp. What was that? What was that old Russian, the cynically Russian saying? There's no. Well, what was it? There was Tass and Pravda and Izvestia. There's no TASS in Pravda, no Pravda in TASS. Because one word meant news and the other word meant truth. This is that! The whole philosophical model. And I'm doing radio, I don't need a chalkboard. The whole philosophical model of everything that Rupert Murdoch does has its roots in Soviet-style, German-style propaganda with a deep bow of gratitude to Hearstian yellow journalism. And the fact that they called it, you know, back then, you know, time, you know, remember the Maine and all that crap. The fact that they called it yellow journalism was not to delineate it as a form of journalism, but to point out that it is not journalism in the first place at all. Any more than Fox is doing news. Obvious. One might think, but from the response that this piece got, it wasn't obvious to the for-profit professional media, and that, you know, that's the real prize inside the Cracker Jack box where this thing is concerned. Howell Raines is writing this as if it's just, yeah, thank you, Cossack. There is no Pravda in Izvestia, and there is no, in Izvestia is no Pravda. There's no truth in news, and in the truth there is no news, and in the news has no truth. I really ought to learn the whole Russian for it, just so that we can get, just so we can learn the secret handshake motto of Fox. This just beats the pants off of me. Because the for-profit media establishment acted like Howell Raines had just written something trenchant. Something that had just dawned. So I guess the lesson is that, you know, if a tree falls in the forest and the for-profit so-called professional media doesn't hear it, no, by God, it doesn't make a sound. No matter how many of us are out there standing in the woods next to the damn log on the ground saying, "The tree fell!" Oh, Muffy, did you hear something? Oh, pay it no mind, dear. I think it's those little people rumbling again. And so Raines concludes, mercifully, I guess, for you, and as much for me, Raines concludes, "As for Fox News, lots of people who know better are keeping quiet about what to call it. Its news operation can, in fact, be called many things, but reporters of my generation with memories and keyboards dare not call it journalism." Really, Hal? What shall we call what you did? During the run-up to the Iraq War. Because we dare not call that journalism either. Oh, by God, we dare not. We dare not at our peril. This is America's listener-supported liberal voice, The Green News Report, with Brad Friedman and Desi Doyen, is on the way. This is listener-supported, liberal media, non-corporate and unconstrained. This is the horn.
I remember your State of the Union address. Your call to duty, you called on our nation's best. You laid it out plain why our sons and daughters should fight. There was no question, it was all in black and white. And like so many, my son believed all of this. Without a shred of doubt, he marched off to enlist. There came a memo from a place called Downing Street. How can this be true? What am I to believe? The flag-draped coffins that you don't want seen on TV. I had something that I'd like you to see. This is the pillow where he used to lay his head. Some old books I would read to him in bed. Here's a trophy from when he played Little League ball. Here's another day I spend staring at the wall. I keep a room of his things, but he's never coming back. Please tell me, why did my son die in Iraq? I need the truth from you, not from one of your paid hacks. Please tell me, why did my son die in Iraq?
Thinking ahead means preparing for the future of our children, our grandchildren, and our wild, wonderful West Virginia. Developing our renewable energy resources is the best way to ensure a clean, sustainable way of life and safe, good-paying jobs for generations to come. Here in the Mountain State, our most abundant energy resource is the wind. Our ridges and majestic mountain peaks shape and direct the wind like stones in a mountain stream. Coal River Mountain is the ideal place for developing wind power. The Coal River Mountain Wind Farm will provide us with a source of clean energy and good jobs forever. We have the power to make our future happen now. Be a part of the clean energy solution for West Virginia by visiting coalriverwind.org or call 304-854-2182. That's coalriverwind.org, 854-2182.
It's Tuesday, March 16th, 2010.
It's a cynical substitute for real energy policy.
The truth about daylight savings time. Another nor'easter hits the Northeast. A settlement for 9/11 Ground Zero workers. Plus, greening up your St. Paddy's Day.
All of that and more straight ahead. I'm Brad Friedman of BradBlog.com.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
Holland has asked the International Climate Committee to please stop advertising that we're 50% underwater. We're not.
No, they're only 25% underwater. See, you dumb hippies, we're only going to drown in 50 years, not 30.
Yeah, you dumb hippies. This is your Green News Report. Today's Green News Report is brought to you by Velvet Revolution's Disbar Torture Lawyers campaign. The DOJ Inspector General has found that Bush's DOJ attorneys committed professional misconduct by approving torture and other war crimes. But the DOJ refuses to refer the findings to state bar associations. So, VR will. Please sign on and donate to help support this important campaign for accountability at disbartorturelawyers.com. That's disbartorturelawyers.com. Okay, Des, I know you can't wait to get to St. Paddy's Day tomorrow and begin your binge drinking like you do every day and every year. But first, what do you have for us today for the green headline?
Oh, well, the record winter of 2010.
You're drunk already, aren't you? Just saying.
Oh, gosh. The record winter of 2010 continues to hammer the Northeast. Over the weekend, an intense nor'easter brought hurricane-force winds, heavy rain, and flooding that killed 7 people and left 500,000 without electricity, the latest in a series of storms this season that have caused massive disruptions for business and travel. Of course, we want to remind you that climate scientists say no one weather event can be tied directly to global warming, but they do predict a trend toward more extreme and intense weather events. Workers at Ground Zero have reached a settlement with the city of New York. According to the New York Times, first responders and cleanup workers in the aftermath of the 9/11 terrorist attacks on the World Trade Center will share a $675 million settlement in compensation for damage to their health from working at the site of the disaster. They allege the city of New York failed to provide proper protection equipment. If approved by the workers, the settlement will be divided among about 10,000 firefighters, police officers, emergency workers, and construction workers whose illnesses range from chronic respiratory ailments to cancer, disability, and death from exposure to toxic air.
You know, this is a huge green story. We were not doing the Green News Report back in 2001, but the fact is the media failed to cover the serious environmental hazards that were going on down there at Ground Zero. Everybody knew about it, at least everybody in the Bush administration. They took no action, and frankly, this settlement, these guys should get a whole hell of a lot more money, and frankly, people ought to go to jail for what they allowed these folks to go through and the health hazards they allowed them to face without proper precautions. That's just my opinion.
Los Angeles is going to make some money from its miles of rooftops. If you've ever flown over Los Angeles or any large city with large industrial parks, you've seen the miles of flat, empty roofs baking in the sun. Now, a Southern California electric utility will begin to utilize some of that unused space with solar panels. They're using a new financing model by leasing all that empty roof space from the building owners.
Well, about damn time. Free energy from the skies. Go figure. Who needs it?
Southern California Edison will own and operate the panels while the building owners will receive ongoing revenue from space they weren't using anyway. And the buildings are already connected to the grid, so the utility saves on the cost of building new transmission lines.
About damn time! Did I already say that?
Yes. Sunday was the start of daylight savings time across most of the country.
Except for those denialists in Arizona and Hawaii.
Yeah. Ever since politicians thought up the idea of daylight savings time, they've been using it as a political football to make it appear as though it results in energy savings. You may be surprised to discover that reality, however, shows otherwise. While some studies have suggested the additional hour of sunlight means less energy is used for lighting, other studies show it doesn't actually save much energy at all. In fact, with more sunlight, Americans apparently tend to get out more, meaning they drive more, meaning they use more gas, meaning the energy savings turns out to be a net loss in reality. Last week on MSNBC's Rachel Maddow show, daylight savings time expert Michael Downing.
Expert? There's experts for daylight savings time?
Yes, believe it or not. He shed some light upon the dim truths about the daylight saving times myth by explaining it this way.
It's a cynical substitute for real energy policy. It's a retail spending plan. It definitely helps some small retail businesses. And it has some social benefits which we all enjoy. Just stop selling it to us as an energy policy and give us something real as a way to conserve.
What a crank.
Finally, tomorrow, Wednesday, is St. Patrick's Day, a great day to do more than just the wearing of the green, but actually going green by sampling organic libations. Website greenopia.com has great recommendations for organic beers. And, of course, organic means more than just no pesticides, insecticides, herbicides, and chemical fertilizers in your beer. It also means reducing waste and pollution in the brewing process, like New Belgium Brewery in Colorado, maker of the popular Fat Tire brand.
Isn't that just like Desi convincing herself she's saving the planet by drinking beer? Read about that and much more at our website, greennews.bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Wearin' O the Green Green News Report.
We know you want to save big on your phone bill, and we know how you can.
That's right. We do.
We're saving more than 50% on our home phone bill since we switched to CityNet's digital phone plan.
Really? Over 50%?
CityNet's digital phone plan is only $24.95 a month.
Only $24.95?
You get unlimited local and long-distance calling.
Just $24.95.
And with CityNet's digital phone plan, you keep your current number. All you need is a high-speed internet connection. Get details at citynet.net.
$24.95.
And, oh, this is cool. With CityNet's digital plan, I can use my home phone anywhere in the world with high-speed internet. No extra cost.
There's 20, and there's 4, and there's 95.
Did I mention CityNet is a West Virginia-owned company?
Did I mention $24.95?
Save at least 50% on your residential phone. Get unlimited local and long distance, and keep your same number, all for just $24.95 a month. Visit citynet.net today for more details. Some exclusions and restrictions may apply.
It's your second hour in the Liberal Sandbox, and you're head-on with Bob Kincaid.
Hey, aren't you loving the new audio fix here? Audio from audio on the horn, getting much, much better. John and I still have some work to do, but wow, did he do a beautiful job working long hours over the weekend. Still got some stuff to fix. It looks like the streaming computer. Never mind. But we've got a computer that does nothing but handle the stream. Has gone in the tank. Well, you know, one door closes, another one opens and slams on my fingers. But no, things are getting better and better as far as the audio quality is going here. And, you know, another testament to the ongoing hard work and willingness to put in countless hours just to make this all go. This is Conversation Radio. This is The Horn. I'm Bob. This is radio that happens because of and solely because of you. I will go ahead and mention again that we are nowhere near here as we pass the halfway mark of the month of March. We are nowhere near halfway to our fundraising goal, which is, you know, $2,000 every month. And frankly, it takes a lot more than that, but that's what we ask for, and the rest we will pour in out of, you know, what we have. but we're nowhere near half that. And I get these little emails from people saying, you know, Bob, you need to put the PayPal button pitch and the snail mail address pitch somewhere besides the very butt end of the show so that folks will hear it and respond. Well, this is that. The PayPal button is at headonradionetwork.com under the tab called Contribute, as is the snail mail address if you prefer not to deal with PayPal. But this exists only because of you, this conversation radio, this attempt to provide some sort of an outlet that is not dominated by the lark's vomit canape, hummingbird tongue, lady finger eating crowd that didn't realize that Fox News had nothing to do with, you know, news. Speaking of which, our good buddy Reverbo, otherwise known as our critic at large and writer for the HeadOnRadioNetwork.com blog, noted with regard to the whole business about Fox News being a brand name, great imagery, nailed it. Hard to believe everyone doesn't realize this, whether they express it that way or not. Perhaps to do so shines the light of hypocrisy upon them. Gee, you think? Yeah, Reverbo, I do think, and I think you think, too. And I think you think you know, I think you think. Oh, dear God, where are we going? Ron in Raleigh says, Bob, it seems that Mr. Raines is channeling his inner Foghorn Leghorn. Poppycock, boy, I say poppycock! Do these people even listen to themselves? Hey, it's a legitimate question. But the whole reason, the whole blessed reason for that hour-long filibobster was something entirely different, which, for all I know, you've probably seen by now. You know this little dust-up that took place last week when Glenn Beck told everybody to run away from their churches if they do social justice, right? Yes, you do. We will take that as read. Well, there were a number of people who objected all the way from, sweet Jesus. Well, all kinds of religion people objected. Jim Wallace of Sojourners, who is a liberal Christian. You know, I'm getting to where more and more I just really reject progressive. Not because Glenn Beck's run me away from it, but because liberal is what it is. Liberal Christian Jim Wallace all the way to the Southern Baptist theologian named Albert Mohler. They all disagree with this. Jesus wasn't into social justice. Social justice is just another word for Nazi communism BS that Glenn Beck came up with on his chalkboard, his crazy board, his loony board. But because he responded to Beck, Beck, of course, then had to respond to Jim Wallace, who continues to say that, you know, I'm not, he says, you know, let's see what here. I thought Beck's rather extreme and misguided comments needed a response, but I did not attack him personally, nor will I. He said, in fact, on Friday I sent Glenn a letter proposing that the two of us sit down together and have an open and public discussion on what social justice really means and how Christians are called to engage in the struggle for justice. I said, quote, let's make this a civil dialogue and not engage in personal attacks on each other, which is never helpful in trying to sort out what is true. So let's talk about the heart of the matter, unquote. Well, there was Jim Wallace's first mistake. And this is, you know, this is not a critique of Jim Wallace. I have profound respect for the brand of Christianity that Jim Wallace practices because it seems to have more in common with the actual life of Yeshua, the brown-skinned Palestinian day laborer, than many other varieties of the practice thereof. But he makes a mistake. He seems to think that Glenn Beck is interested in dialogue. There is not a right-winger out there who has ever been behind a microphone doing a radio show, which is the origin of Glenn Beck's shtick, that is interested in dialogue. Whether it's Rush Limbaugh or that life support system for a haircut, Sean Hannity, O'Reilly, even though he got run off of radio, Savage, none of those freaks have any interest in dialogue whatsoever because they are right-wingers and they are authoritarians, and by dint of operation of both, they are into marching orders, not dialogue. Dialogue is for liberals. We process. We work toward a correct answer or a factual understanding of a given set of circumstances or a given phenomenon. The right wing doesn't operate that way. The right wing operates by walking up to you, balling up its fist, and trying to drive your nose into the back of your skull, and then seeing if you will punch them back. And when you don't, they punch you in the gut. And when you still don't punch you in the back, they stomp you on your instep so you'll double over, and then they deliver a devastating uppercut to your chin that'll rattle your teeth loose. Once you hit the ground, they put the boot on your neck and start kicking you in your damn kidneys. That is how the right wing operates. And that is Fox News. So consequently, when Jim put his kumbaya, and I mean no disrespect, but that's what it is. When Jim put his little kumbaya letter out there, Beck rose to the bait. But he rose to the bait like some sort of shark rising to the bait. Have you ever seen what happens when you chum for shark? You know, come on, Discovery Channel, that kind of stuff. Nature on PBS. You chum for shark, and sharks come from all over because they smell blood in the water, and they become fiercer. They become meaner. They become more bloodthirsty. Well, on Glenn Beck's radio show yesterday, Glenn responded to Jim Wallace. This is what he said. I don't have the audio for you, but this is what he said. So, Jim, I just wanted to pass this on to you. In my time, I will respond. My time. Well, kind of like God's time. Might be a day, might be a week to you. I'm not sure. But I'm going to get to it in my time, not your time. So you go ahead. And you continue to do your protest thing. And that's great. I love it. But just know, the hammer is coming. Because little do you know, for 8 weeks, we've been compiling information on you, your cute little organization, and all the other cute little people that are with you. And when the hammer comes, it's going to be hammering hard and all through the night, over and over. It's weird how people all over the world have been sending me stuff. It's weird that way, Jimmy. Glenn Beck will be defended to the absolute death over at Fox. And he has just threatened the life, on air, he has just threatened the life of the Reverend Jim Wallace for daring to extend an olive branch to him and call for dialogue in the spirit of the teachings of Yeshua, the brown-skinned Palestinian day laborer. He threatened his life. The hammer is coming. And when the hammer comes, it's going to be hammering hard and all through the night, over and over. Has Glenn Beck gone a little bit insane? Gone? It's hard to go insane when you've been insane for years and years and years, when you rotted your own brain with drugs and alcohol and weird-ass religion and all the business that Glenn Beck put his poor, poor, substandard brain through in the first place. I mean, his brain is twisted by the fact that he's got histories. You know, his own mother or father, both of them, don't know, one of them, killed themselves committed suicide just to get away from the hell that they had spawned on Earth in the form of Glenn? The hammer is coming. For 8 weeks, we've been compiling information on you. Does he think this is going to scare Jim Wallace? Probably not. But it certainly gives spine, inspiration, if you will, to the mouth breathers and the knuckle walkers who listen to him. And that's the kind of inspiration that makes people pick up guns and go and do with those guns what Glenn Beck does not have the courage to do himself. Because Glenn Beck is, after all, at the end of it all, a coward. And yeah, the egomania is on display for anyone who wants to look at it. I will respond, my time. Well, kind of like God's time. He just compared himself to God Almighty, whoever or whatever God Almighty might be. Might be a day, might be a week to you, I'm not sure. But I'm going to get to it in my time, not your time. Now, Glenn is also an uber heterosexual, right? I mean, there's nothing gay about Glenn Beck, right? But when you're an uber heterosexual, you have to be careful with what you say. Because, well, remember, Sigmund Freud's great-grandson is a big buddy of Rupert Murdoch. And I'm sure Matthew Freud has probably read some of great-granddaddy's writings and might be just a little bit curious, you know, latency and all that stuff, might be just a little curious to hear a card-carrying heterosexual speaking to another male and saying, when the hammer comes, it's going to be hammering hard and all through the night, over and over. God, you can... Wow! Dr. Freud, white courtesy phone. Dr. Freud, white courtesy phone. Emergency. Code latent. When the hammer comes, it's going to be hammering hard all through the night, over and over. Yummy. That's the true face of Fox News. Yeah, it was said on his radio show. And yeah, the radio show is not from Fox. But Fox is where... Fox is the purpose of all of this, because he won't use the radio show to expose Jim Wallace. He'll use the Fox television show. Yeah, Lottie, see? Bob, my gaydar does spastic around Beck. And Lottie noting in the chat room. By the way, if you've never been to the headonradionetwork.com chat room, why not? Great little group in there. Pop in anytime. You know, it's free and easy. Lottie noting, if you take Beck down, you can take Fox down. See, I differ just a little. You know, all we need is a Beck scandal. I differ just a little bit, Lottie, because a scandal would take a liberal down. A scandal will not, however, take a right-winger down. Larry Craig? Rush Limbaugh. You know, come on, Rush Limbaugh, for Christ's sakes. The guy was busted doctor shopping and walked on it. You know, how many... David Vitters visited hookers and had a really... fairly extreme fetish, if you believe the sex workers of New Orleans. He's still serving in the Senate. IOKIYAR. It's okay if you're a Republican. No, a liberal would be run off the air for anything that smelled of scandal. But not someone at Fox and not Glenn Beck. Because, again, news and integrity have nothing to do with what Fox does. What Fox does has everything to do with marketing, with the acquisition of money, and with propaganda. Jesus, for all we know, Joseph Goebbels dressed up in a tutu every night. I mean, the Nazis were a kinky bunch. It took Nuremberg to take them down. Those, you know, the Kinkensteins, especially the closeted types, will protect their own. So, no, the only thing that will take Glenn Beck down is money. Money will take Glenn Beck down. When it is no longer profitable for Fox News to run Glenn Beck, then Glenn Beck will go away. So, you know, just a little food for thought. Listen, that's enough with me. This is Conversation Radio, not Filibobster Radio. It's 25 minutes before the hour. We're halfway done with the program. Light them up if you want to. The phones, that is. 877-443-2366, 877, the numeral 4, head on. If you want to do it on your nickel and save us a little bit of money, 304-658-3333 is the number. And we go forthwith to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hello, Bob. This is Bruce Birch. How you doing?
Bruce Birch, how are you, my friend?
I'm doing great, man. Sounds like you really got a good rant, but you missed one.
I missed one?
J. Edgar Hoover.
Oh, well, yeah. Yeah, but he was too big for the tutu. He's more like the stunning floral print cocktail frock.
The hippopotamus, you know. I just
the hippopotamus in the, right, from Fantasia, right?
Exactly. Oh, my goodness.
My God, you haven't lost anything in the time away.
Well, you know, you got to keep it sharp. I mean, you know, it's one of those things where life goes on, my friend. But, you know, it's really cool to listen to your show tonight, and it amazes me. That, well, you know what? No, it doesn't. It really doesn't. It's you know, I was having a conversation earlier with somebody, and we were discussing things that come up in the news periodically that happen just often enough that if you stick to the news and listen to the news and watch the news, that it becomes commonplace. But if you don't, it's like comes out of nowhere and people go, what? And one of those things was, you know, these people who have their parents live, you know, still in the house 14 years after they've perished. And another one is, you know, Republicans who get caught in men's rooms or other establishments when they are purporting to be uber heterosexuals.
Right. The family values Republicans.
So, you know, it just, you know, it's more of the same stuff. It's, you know, and I guess what really gets to me is, you know, nobody sees this. Nobody reads about it. Nobody seems to really, maybe they just don't give a damn, Bob. I don't know.
No, it's a part, for the right-wing side of it, Bruce, it's a function of the authoritarian mindset. You know, and whether you're just talking about plain old garden variety authoritarianism that says, you know, people have feet of clay, but, you know, they're great nonetheless, and we will overlook their foibles. You know, these fundamentalist phony baloney Christians don't have much in the way of forgiveness for the rest of us, but they got it by the bucketful for their own fallen. On the other hand, there's organizations out there that like C Street, which I'm sure you're familiar with.
Sure.
And the operating philosophy behind C Street, Bruce, is not just that, you know, well, people have feet of clay, people make mistakes, and we must forgive. They have an open and out there operating philosophy that says, not only, you know, it never mind the feet of clay, it doesn't matter because they're better than we are. They get to do it because they're better than us, because they are among the elect. It's neo-Calvinism. And, you know, you got to remember the Texas school book standards, where they just excised Thomas Jefferson from the world history curriculum in favor of John Calvin. John Calvin ordered people to the stake. John Calvin had people killed. John Calvin wasn't an American. Okay? But what he was the progenitor of the idea that God has a list of human beings on earth that he likes better than other human beings, and the way he manifests that is by making them wealthy.
So let me ask you, Bob, when does the next gun show? I'm just trying to
What next? I mean, aren't you still in North Carolina?
Yes, I am.
Well, there's a statute in North Carolina that says there has to be a gun show somewhere in that state every day of the week.
You're absolutely right. You know, we had the ACC tournament in town this weekend.
Yes, you did.
And I got to tell you, you know, I've never seen so many idiots collected in one place at one time at this.
Oh, Duke fans?
Sure.
Sorry, that couldn't resist. But...
Well, I'm a Cavaliers fan, but you know, hey, you know, it is what it is.
Yeah, tough year.
Yeah, but you know, that's the kind of stuff that happens in Greensboro, and I bring that up to say, you know, when the gun shows, I mean, Greensboro Coliseum is like a hub of activity around all kinds of different kinds of events.
Sure.
And, you know, when the gun show nuts show up or the Market America people, oh, they're the best. The Market America people?
Market America? Oh, enlighten me.
Yes. Well, Market America is very similar. It's the Amway.
I was going to say, it sounds a lot like Amway.
It's the Amway reinvented with a whole new cultist approach and, you know, and they have teams of, it's capitalism at its finest. It truly is. It's just, it's a wonderful thing to watch. I mean, it makes you want to bring the hammer down hard and fast. Wait a minute. excuse me.
Sorry.
Yeah, I got a little carried away there. Sorry about that. No, but they do. They wear these shirts. They have these teams of people, and it's just incredible to watch how stupid and crazy these people are because they truly do follow this all. You're talking about, you know, God and wealth, and I figured we could throw Market America in there because, you know, the bottom line is that, you know, I'm going to say it, man, that this, you know, I'm tying it all together. Wait for it. You know, the whole thing with the healthcare fiasco that's going on and, you know, people are so scared to death of giving up a little bit of their hard-earned wealth to help their fellow man. And it just, and they chase after it. So, I can't even find the word.
Obsessively?
Obsessively, yes. Compulsively, even. You know, that, you know, all we end up with, man, there's a lot of pain and suffering around the rest of us, and I guess that's what's so sad about what I see going on with our president right now. And I really have a hard time supporting this guy at this point. And yeah, he's a Democrat, and he brought in all of Bill Clinton's folks, and you know, tried to do a repeat offender status. He's you know, he's tried to bring everybody to the table, and you know what the reality is that, you know.
But there are some people who don't belong at the table.
There are some people who don't, and exactly what I was going to say is that, you know, the reality is that some of these folks don't deserve a place at the table, and some of these folks need to have their butt smacked on the way out the room. And I don't mean in a, you know,
room-playing
kind of way. I mean in a, you know, kick your ass out of here kind of way.
But yeah, Bruce, you know, anybody who's ever been at a very, very large family Thanksgiving dinner understands the concept of the grown-ups table.
Yes.
Because, you know, you put the grown-ups around one table, and then all the little kids, the cousins and stuff, you know, they get their own table so that they can throw food at each other. Because, you know, it's a holiday, and once a year, Mama and Dad don't want to have food thrown at them.
Right, and that's the Glenn Beck table. That's the...
Right, you know, that's the Republican Party. You know, they don't have any business at this table because at this point, their nearest comparison, and it's a negative toward their nearest comparison is chimpanzees flinging poop in a zoo.
Yeah.
And frankly, it is denigrating to the chimpanzee.
Yeah. I totally, you know, and it's just, it, you know. So tell me, Bob, what do you think the, you know, what's going to get this guy to grow a set?
I think he's already got one. But my personal guess is that he really bought into the idea that, you know, you work with other people, you reach across the aisle and blah, blah, blah. And apparently he has a regenerative power to grow back. Every time he, you know, reaches across the aisle and draws back a bloody stump, a new hand grows.
Bizarre, isn't
it? Well, it is. And it's very frustrating, and it's not, and to be fair to, you know, I've been called on the carpet a couple of times, Bruce, for being too hard on Obama and forgetting about the Senate and the House. It is not a phenomenon that is exclusive to Barack Obama.
I was going to get to Harry Reid and Nancy Pelosi, but I don't know we have time for that. I mean, you know, it blows my mind Will Rogers once said he didn't belong to an organized political party. He was a Democrat.
Right. Exactly.
And I think that, you know, especially of late, that could be nowhere more evidenced than by what's going on up there right now and what's gone on over the last year. It is disgraceful to our party, to the Democratic Party, of which I'm a member, you know, to watch this go on. And you know, if the Republicans would have passed this 9 months ago, you know, and said, you know what, you want to complain? You know, shut the F up. We don't want to hear it.
Well, but not just that, Bruce, but the fact of the matter is the argument that I made earlier with regard to Fox that, you know, news is merely a brand name, applies to the Republican Party in general as well. They aren't interested in governing. They aren't interested in a health care bill. They are not, even though they, you know, you can't swing a dead skunk around Republicans without hitting one of them waving a flag. They have no more interest in the flag or in patriotism or in America or in what's good for this country than a hog does in a Sunday suit.
Exactly.
And so as a consequence of that, you know, why are any of us surprised? And I suppose to the extent that we're not, the question is, why is the Democratic leadership surprised when Republicans behave like Republicans? You know, it's the old joke about the woman who takes the injured rattlesnake home and nurses it back to health.
Yeah.
You know, eventually she gets bitten by the rattlesnake and says, you know, my God, you were wounded. I picked you up. I carried you. I brought you to my home. I nursed you back to health. Why would you do this to me? And the rattlesnake looks up and says, honey, you knew all along I was a rattlesnake.
Yep.
Well, we know they're rattlesnakes, Bruce. But maybe it's because they live in close proximity to each other and they get up in the floor of the Senate. My esteemed Senator colleague from South Carolina and my dear friend, Michelle Bachmann from Minnesota. You know, maybe when you use that kind of phony baloney gentrification, it begins to stick and you actually think that these people have something in common with you when in fact they don't. When in fact they would knife you in the back if they got a chance. No morals, no filtering, no nothing. The only thing that constrains them is the threat of prison or the chair. You know, it's always right wingers, Bruce, who are hollering, we need capital punishment because it keeps people from committing murders. Well, you know what? It doesn't keep me from committing a murder. I don't commit murder because I believe that committing murder is wrong. But I will submit to you that the chair probably does serve as a deterrent to most right-wingers because it's the only thing that keeps them from doing that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Because they're primal. They are in it for themselves, and they will, you know, was it G. Gordon Liddy during the Watergate years who said he would, or someone said of him that he would run over his own grandmother in the street if it was something that Richard Nixon wanted? You remember the story? Remember the story? Was it Liddy or Colson or one of them that just, you know?
I think it might have been Chuck Colson.
Held his hand over a burning candle flame, you know, to prove his loyalty to Richard Nixon. That's, you know, granted, that was 1970, 1971, 1972, but it hasn't changed, Bruce.
The mindset is still there. You know, the mindset is still there. And I was even going to venture out to say that, I was watching something on C-SPAN over the weekend. It was some sort of roundtable discussion at the Center for American Progress, and there was a Democratic senator up there who was complaining about the lack of civility. And I don't remember. I think it was I'm not sure who it was.
Oh, did you run out into the yard naked screaming again?
Well, no, I didn't run out. Well, okay, I did. But just keep that between you and me.
Okay, right, nobody's listening.
Nobody's listening, so... No, but, you know, I was listening to this, and I thought, my God, you know, to sit around and pine after the good old days when everybody got together for a barbecue on the front lawn of the White House in the 1870s, you know, all of the Democrats and Republicans, and it was a different time then. You didn't get on the floor of the Senate and chastise your opponents because you had lunch together on Saturday, and, you know, and I'm thinking to myself, you know, there's lives at stake. There are people right now who are in their hospital beds dying because of our health care problem.
Right, and what's more, Bruce, there are 45,000 Americans who aren't in hospital beds, who won't be in hospital beds, who will just drop damn dead.
Exactly. But we need civility, Bob. We got to have civility. We can't, you know, we can't just argue over life and death issues with any kind of passion. You know, we can't go out, venture out, and make decisions that actually will help someone. We have to come to a bipartisan agreement and make sure that everyone is happy. See, bullshit. Oh, almost did it. Almost did it, Bob.
Yeah, well, you know, I wouldn't.
I threw the brown word out there.
Yeah, but I know. That's okay. I brown worded earlier. Sometimes it just can't. You can't help yourself. Hey, by the way, in reference to your earlier comment, our buddy Ron in Raleigh just wrote in and said, "Tell my fellow Cavalier fan that the Dixie Classic Gun and Knife Show will be in Raleigh very soon. I'll drop an email when it's going to happen. Lock and load."
I love it. Well, you know what? There's something to be said for having guns. I used to tell people on my show, you know, the bottom line is I want to have one to, you know, fight back the Republicans when they try to take us over. So, you know, time will tell on that.
No, you know, I mean,
I better not say that because of reasons I can't disclose. I shouldn't be having any kind of firearm. But
right, I understand.
Especially.
But you know what? Given what we talked about last night, and you probably weren't tuned in. Just a quick recap. It turns out, you remember the 9/11 truther who went up and shot up the Pentagon Metro Station on March the 3rd?
Yeah.
Okay. One of the guns he was carrying was sold into the stream of holy commerce by the Memphis Police Department.
That's crazy.
And Tennessee now has a law that compels police departments to sell guns used in criminal activities back into the stream of holy gun commerce.
That's crazy.
So you got it. You know, I would love to walk through. What was it? I got to go back here. I would love to walk through the Dixie Classic Gun and Knife Show and just guess at how many of the firearms that are for sale there, no background check, no waiting period, no nothing,
have been used to kill other people.
Have already been used to kill another human being, to rob another human being, to threaten another human being. Right.
That's crazy. That is absolutely bat crap.
See?
Crazy.
Right, yeah.
Oh my goodness. Well,
but somewhere on that green baize or on the plastic or vinyl tablecloth, somewhere in the Dixie Gun and Knife Show, there are going to be guns from police departments that were used to kill other human beings. Guns with a history. Guns with proven effectiveness.
Proven effectiveness at stopping a man. Lord have mercy. What are we going to do, Bob? You know, I know exactly what I'm going to do. I'm going to live one more day and to rant on and try to help change the way things are. That's all I know to do.
Live another day to fight another day.
Exactly.
Can't run.
It's been great talking with you.
Good talking with you, Bruce.
Got to keep going, but you know, I'll call back in sometime soon. You know, you haven't lost your touch in getting the truth out there in a way that's very palatable, and I commend you for it.
I haven't been described as palatable in quite some time.
Well, see, that's because I haven't been around.
That's true. That's true.
All right, my friend.
Bruce Birch, take care, brother.
Okay.
Later. Bye. Bye now. From Colin from Greensboro area, that's our old buddy, Bruce Birch, who was around for the birthing of all of this. The second show ever to be added to the Horn lineup was, in fact, Fourth Estate Radio with John Fox and Bruce Birch. You know that we've been around for a while when you can look back and say, dang, them was the days. That's almost 6 years ago. Whew. That says something, doesn't it? Good to hear from Bruce. Now, okay, there's the phone a-ringing. Let's see who this is. Yes, indeed. All right, stand by. Here we go. And we will be, there we are. Hey, welcome to the program.
Welcome back, Mr. Bob Kincaid.
Thank you, Mr. David. How are you?
Well, I'm doing all right. I did want to mention, I have a theme for Tuesday.
Yes?
Triumphant Tuesdays.
I like the concept.
Basically, all it consists of is someone where you have a bit of triumphant news.
Would you happen to be able to help with that?
Oh, yes, I do. Oh, I do. Did you hear about the news in Antarctica?
No.
Well, this is important, people, and this is kind of like evidence of our society quickly devolving into something that we don't like, and where we put something like on a back burner because we don't understand how important a find like this. But in an Antarctica shelf, now picture this, people, an Antarctica ice sheet, deep down, they decided to just see what was in the water. So they cut a hole 8 inches into the abyss. They bring a cable down 8 inches. And the minute they put a cable, Bob, a 3-inch shrimp attaches itself right to the cable. They're going to release footage pretty soon, too.
Now, walk me through this again.
Yes.
I want to get this right.
Okay. They decided to look inside a sheet in Antarctica, a sheet of ice. And they
So it's still frozen. It is still in its ice state.
Yes, it's still in its ice state. So they decided to look at the sample core, and they decided to take, like, they didn't expect anything. They didn't expect any creatures, nothing. And what happened was they put a cable down, and the creature, this 3-inch shrimp, that's what they're calling it. It's a shrimp-like creature. This 3-inch shrimp attaches itself to the cable when they pull it up.
From inside solid ice?
Yes. Now here's the fact that you have to consider. Now here's the thing where it starts to boggle the mind.
No, my mind's already boggled.
I know, but this is where it really starts to boggle the mind, because, I forgot to mention that they pulled up a piece of a jellyfish as well. That wasn't an actual whole creature, but it was like a piece of a jellyfish on the cable.
Had it been recently living?
Yes.
Wow.
Now, here's the amazing thing about it, is that they were baffled because they didn't expect to see anything. So once you're pressed into that environment and you see something instantly, without even searching, people, without even searching, they literally just took an 8-inch and they said, all right, let's go down, let's move the cable. It was like a scene from Abyss or something. And they only quicker, though. They found the creature quicker. So, you know, the thing that's amazing is that, okay, how does a creature like that live in there? And they can't figure it out.
I'm stumped.
I know.
I mean, you would think that ice is ice and ice is solid, and ice is, you know, never mind the frozen part of it even, you know, just getting past that. It's solid. How do you...
Right. And the important thing to real, the important thing to, I wanted to mention to people, because I wanted to get them, interested, because they're going to release the footage pretty soon. And not many people are talking about this. But I found this completely fascinating, and my mind was starting to reel, and it was like we were talking before, where ocean, we've had this discussion before, ocean has always been space 2.0 or space 1.0, whatever you want to call it.
Okay, so John Fox has just kindly provided me the news article.
Right.
And so it's 600 feet below the ice.
Right.
Not in the ice itself, but below the ice.
Yes.
Total darkness. Darkness mm-hmm. as deep and dark as that of deepest space, which I guess is why NASA decided to do this. Deep core drill.
Mm-hmm.
And they get 600 feet below the ice.
Right.
And there's all this life going on.
I think it's amazing the fact that they actually had a creature that came up to say hi to him, like a sign.
Yeah, a curious shrimp-like creature came swimming by and then parked itself on the camera's cable. And the tentacle of a foot-long jellyfish.
Mm-hmm.
NASA-sized scientist Robert Binshadler said, "We were operating on the presumption that there's nothing there. It was shrimp you'd enjoy having on your plate." You know, which immediately goes to the first comment coming from Lottie in the chat room. Did they have a jar of cocktail sauce handy?
No, they didn't.
And the video is already up.
Oh, it is up. Okay, I have to look at it then. I've been looking for it for a little bit of time. So that's the first story I wanted to bring people's attention to.
Absolutely, that's amazing. And
yeah.
And you know I'm a total sucker for these kind of stories. Did you catch the story about the mass Viking grave in England the other day?
I don't think I caught that story, no.
Oh, that, well, you know, you and I can do this because, you know, you're the pop culture correspondent.
Yeah, yeah.
Scientists in England announced the discovery of a mass Viking grave. Okay,
wow.
Well, so what? Well, it was down, I guess, on the southern tip of England, not too far from the coast itself. But, you know, close enough to make a difference. And they did these incredibly detailed analysis of, like, the teeth and the bones, and they can actually now tell what the diet was.
Mm.
And it was by that they determined that this was a mass grave of people who came from places that weren't England and that were very much more likely to have been what is now Norway and Sweden. For our Norwegian and Swedish audience component. One of them went even so far north as to have been presumably from above the Arctic Circle.
Mm.
And the grave predates the Norman conquest. And here's the fun part, because there were like 35 of these guys, and all guys.
Right.
They had all been killed by being beheaded.
Wow.
And this was at a time when England was under constant attack from pillaging bands of Vikings, who were probably both Agnes and my forebears, except the ones who got their heads cut off. But, you know, because of the, you know, if you're of Scots-Irish descent and you've got red hair or reddish hair or strawberry blonde hair and the light eyes and stuff, you didn't come straight off the northern tip of the British island of Great Britain or Ireland. You came at some point from a raiding party that came from Scandinavia. And, it, I mean, it just is. But it's the time when there was great fluidity of change between, the Angles and Saxons up to, you know, the Norman conquest, you know, King Alfred and King, you know, the Vikings conquered and it was King Canute. And then they were overturned. Eugene Finnerman is much better at all this than I am. But there came a time when, for instance, and I know Eugene has commented on this, there came a time when it got to the point where the Vikings would leave settlement parties or traders and artisans. And at one point in time, all the English rose up and went and killed them. And I couldn't help reading this, but wondering if this was evidence of that. But it's absolutely fascinating. And, you know, of course, reading that 35 human beings were beheaded, and they weren't nicely beheaded. You know, we usually think of beheadings as, you know, the guillotine or a really sharp axe. Beheadings were not nice through history. The reason that most people don't realize that Dr. Guillotine invented that device as an act of humanity. Because if the sword was even the least bit dull or the axe was the least bit dull, the headsman would sit there and have to chop for a while to get the headset, you know, because it does, you know, they're not made to just snap right off. We ain't Barbie dolls.
Right.
And so they'd have to sit and hack for a while, and these skeletons were hacked all to pieces but they weren't hacked in such a way as to make it obvious that they had died in battle. They were chopped around the head and shoulders and neck. You know, so they had to, you know, they had to work at it for a while. And the first thing that popped into my mind was, well, you know, I'm going to remember this story every time some right-winger wants to talk about the barbarism of the Arabs lopping people's heads off. Because, you know, it's not like we don't do that. It's not like we don't have the history. You know, when you think about the history of the conquest of Mexico, for instance, David.
Yeah.
You know, the Spanish priests were just horrified, I tell you. To find that there was human sacrifice going on. And what would happen in ancient Mexico was they would have a war. They were called flowery wars or wars of flowers, where the purpose was not to kill your enemy but to capture him. And captured enemies were taken back to the respective cities and sacrificed to the gods for whom human blood was literally the sweat of the sun. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And it was a noble and an honorable death, and it sent you, you know, straight to ancient Mesoamerican heaven called Tonatiuhcan. And the Spaniards were horrified. Oh, you're committing human sacrifice. And having found out a little bit just by description of what the culture was back in Mother Spain and Mother Church, and having seen that the way the church operated in Nueva España, the indigenous people said, wait a minute, you're horrified at us? We do this quick, and we do it to the glory of God, and the people go willingly. On the other hand, you're burning people to death who don't want to be burnt, who have no promise of eternal salvation, and then you display their bloody corpses until the birds have picked them clean? Who's the barbarian here? Unfortunately, the Spanish had firearms and were thereby able to answer that question with rather prompt dispatch. So, no, well, like I said, you know I love these stories.
Yeah, and one thing before I go, I wanted to mention this because I think it's a sign of, you know, there's so many people who don't engage themselves, Bob, and they keep to themselves, and they don't open that door. And what I'm going to encourage people to do is open the door. And this is what I mean by that, because there are people out there who have talents, who have abilities that they don't share with the world. And this is to tie in with the first story about how you just look underneath the surface and you never know what you're going to find. Well, this person that I discovered on the web, that a lot of people have discovered on the web. I don't know if you heard of, have you heard of a guy named Merton?
Depends on the context.
Well, I'm sure you're aware of Chat Roulette, right?
Yeah, I have been becoming more so, yes.
Okay, well, Merton decided to do something that was, it's absolutely fascinating. What he decided to do was he decided to incorporate his piano. And he has the first video up where he actually does improv songs to people that pop up. So it's an instant interaction of them hearing music about them and their first impression. And it's fascinating to watch the reactions of people who are not expecting that, who are just expecting someone with a drone look on their face or someone showing their private parts. But to have this happen, and it's amazing because the fact that he's already got the, he's put out that impression the first time. I mean, it's catching on like wildfire. I mean, there's sure to be a second video and a third video, but he's a pioneer in the field. I wonder what would happen if you bring a piano and you react to people instantly on first impression. What happens?
That's got to be neat.
I haven't
found the nerve to work up Chat Roulette yet.
Well, you know, the problem I have with an application like Chat Roulette, and this shows exactly what I'm talking about. People who are right at the door and they just need to open it. Merton's a perfect example. He saw the door for himself, and using his own ingenuity and just using his own curiosity and creativity, he said, I wonder what will happen if you do this. I'm going to set up my piano. I'm just going to hit the Chat Roulette button, and I'm going to make up improv songs. And you know, that's the kind of thing that's the kind of thing that this world needs, Bob, which is a constant undying search for ingenuity and creativity. And those people are going to make the world a hell of a lot of difference. Before I go, I'm reminded of a quote from a novel. And he says, he says, you're just a drop in an endless ocean. And the guy responds back to him, what is an ocean but a multitude of drops?
Well, exactly. That's like that classic old gag about the two young fish swimming in the ocean one day, and the old fish swims by and says, water's nice this morning.
Yeah.
And just swims along, and the two young fish look at each other and say, what's this water he's talking about? You know, you can live in a world and never know what the world is. What is an ocean but an agglomeration of drops? Absolutely.
Right, right. I just wanted to share that with you, and I will send you the link to this this Merton character so you can see for yourself.
Yeah, I'll enjoy that because I've been sort of intrigued by Chat Roulette, but also equally horrified because I don't want to hit the button and, you know, see somebody naked sitting in front of me. I just don't want to do that.
Yeah,
or for that matter, you know, somebody doing his best Joseph Goebbels in a tutu impression. I'm not ready for it. I can't cope.
It does open up for a broad expansion of advertising for the horn by wearing a horn T-shirt or something.
Ooh,
just going across the whole entire world. First impressions, people. First impressions.
Well, there you go.
All exactly. Right, Bob. You have a good one.
All right. You take care, David.
All right,
bye
right.
Now.
Bye.
600 feet below the surface of the Antarctic ice sheet, life. And I would expect no one other than our pop culture correspondent, David, from Maine, to bring that to us. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, how are you, Bob? Hey, you know, I'm another David. I'm in San Francisco. This is the first time I've heard your show.
Oh, wow. We've got a new David.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, it's kind of funny. I was listening to that bit about the pulling up the, was it the, not the divining rod, but the sample from underneath the Antarctic.
Right.
It just kind of crossed my mind. You know, when you're a little kid and you make the mistake of sticking your tongue to a frozen flagpole?
You know, I don't call that a mistake. I call that a learning experience.
Well, I did, and I almost missed class because of it. But I wonder if that's what happens to critters way down below the Antarctic, and something comes along like that. That's just the form of them sticking their tongue onto it. So, and, you know, I'm kind of interested in a whole different topic, and that's the economy and why the Democrats don't seem to be doing anything logical. You know, they seem to be sort of piggybacking onto the Republican economic sphere. And it, after living through the .com out here, I don't know if you or any of your other listeners were involved in .com, but I mean, it was crazy money here. Of course, everybody knew that there were .com millionaires just flying around like crazy, but I mean, it really was an insane world. We were talking about how high rent gotten out here in San Francisco, and there was actually a point where they had gotten so expensive that it was $5,000 for a studio. And
by that you mean like 450 square feet?
Something ridiculously small, yeah, sure. And so, you know, this it was crazy money out here. And since Pelosi is married to one of the wealthiest people in the state, and also Senator Feinstein is married to one of the wealthiest people in the state, they would certainly love to get onto that fast track of easy money that .com brought for here. And healthcare, to me, is one of those scams. In other words, if you're invested into pharmaceuticals, if you're invested in HMOs, if you're invested in, you know, many of the other very lucrative investment portfolios, so to speak, the healthcare scammers are essentially bringing in returns. You know, I know a woman who essentially inherited quite a bit of money, and she really won't accept anything from her broker less than 15%. Now, 15% can be pretty devastating when you've got a lousy economy like this where there's virtually no growth. And 15% is devastating for any kind of company to have to live up to. For
In short, David, it's unsustainable.
Absolutely. I'm agreeing, just to let you know. And one of the major key values of the Green Party, one of the 10 key values out here, is sustainability. And you're absolutely right. I mean, the basic concept of usury or Thomas Jefferson's second inaugural, he was talking about the basis of the economy should be on agriculture with commerce as its handmaiden. So everything should be related to nature and what nature can sustain, and then commerce should be secondary to that. You know, you shouldn't live by what these guys who are dreaming up pie-in-the-sky kind of equations. Nature shouldn't have to live up to their dreams. They should be forced to live in the real world and get real returns based upon the real world.
Absolutely right, David, and among other things, it is worth noting that when you talk about those 15% numbers, that's those are Bernie Madoff numbers, which leads me to since you're a new listener to the program, you're probably no insult intended, catching up with the curve of what the style of the show is and everything, but we have little truisms here, and I am more prone to follow W.C. Fields' three commandments than I am to the Bible's 10.
And they are,
you can't cheat an honest man, never give a sucker an even break, and don't smarten up a chump. And I don't say live by them, but if you pay attention to those, it's awfully hard to get done wrong. And the Bernie Madoff, you can have 15% return on your investment kind of stuff, that's you can't cheat an honest man right off the bat. Because anybody out there looking for 15% return, whether it's a no growth or some growth or cancerous growth economy, because always remember that any time something is growing faster than the host organism can support it, the word for that is cancer, and it's terminal. And anytime you've got somebody looking for that kind of growth, they're setting themselves up for a really ugly fall because it is not real.
Right. Yeah. That somewhat of a personality of a parasite, but that they're looking for a cohabitation with other parasites. So they're doomed for a fall. You know, what I was leading up to with this, for many years, essentially a dozen years, I traveled around the country with a research company, and I studied personal injury cases. So I learned a great deal about, conservatism and liberalism and the real life and how communities in a whole lot of the Midwest were really living based upon their lawsuits. And one of the ugly things that I discovered was that there were a whole lot of secret settlements. And with various polluters, with various corporations, they have, say, for example, the current problems with Toyota. There may have been secret settlements regarding these faulty cars years ago. And the fact that people accepted money based upon crashes, the public was never made aware of the reality of these dangers some years ago. I'm speculating with.
I don't think it's that speculative, David, because most of those major product liability settlements, or at least my understanding of them, are that there is a non-disclosure clause inside every one of them. That says thou shalt not go out and say I settled with Toyota for $1.5 million.
Right.
And Toyota's a great case in point because of all this breaking news about the so-called, what do they call it, the Book of Facts? I saw a report with one personal injury lawyer who had a case where one of these cars ran away. His client was horribly mangled, and he settled. And the whole time, this Toyota Book of Facts, which is a documentation of everything that was going wrong, this Book of Facts was made, everything was transferred offshore back to Japan and held in Japan so that it would be beyond the subpoena powers of the United States District Court.
Sure, absolutely. And so what I was trying to correlate was these people who are trying to maintain these, 15% growths, if there are secret settlements, then they never disclose to the stockholders, the shareholders of the company, these dangerous products, and the shareholders are never given option about whether or not they can escape from a bad investment, force a cleanup of hazardous waste, force safety on the assembly line, a whole lot of different opportunities for causing danger and damage and mischief. So the stockholders are both cheated as well as the public. You know, in the Constitution it says that we have the right to a public trial. And so when these secret settlements happen, they're cheating both the stockholder as well as the public. And one of the greatest hazards that I learned in all of this was, and you're probably well aware of this Supreme Court ruling just a month ago giving corporate power, you know, that whole corporate personhood has created a situation where if you're poisoned by some hazardous waste, asbestos even, you know, it's been known for 80 or 100 years even that asbestos was a hazardous waste, but essentially in each and every case, you have to prove the chemical is innocent until proven guilty.
Yes, you have to prove it again and again and again and again.
Absolutely, and so they have to start from scratch at each given case.
Yeah, even though the common law and codified law in the United States contains provisions, the ancient legal provision of res judicata, where something that has been a thing that has been adjudged by a court of competent jurisdiction may be taken as fact and not retried. But with things like product liability cases, asbestos cases, poisoning cases, that all gets thrown out the window for reasons that I don't understand, and you have to reinvent the wheel with every case. You're absolutely right.
Well, right, and that's the scam that's been going on with all of these cases for years. In criminal courts, you know, if someone is found guilty of some sort of a fraud or a felony, they have to essentially have a trail following them around. But these civil cases are not looked at in the same light, and so they're still in, even though they may have poisoned tens of thousands of people in the past, they're still innocent until proven guilty, even if it's an ongoing situation. For many months, I was calling up around Alabama, Tennessee, Kentucky, Mississippi, trying to warn them about a huge Tennessee Valley Authority spill that happened down there. And
Kingston?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. And, you know, that thing was, 130-fold bigger, 130 times bigger than the Exxon Valdez spill. And it's slowly this mush of hazardous waste, arsenic, cadmium, lead, mercury, radioactive isotopes is slowly making its way down the Tennessee River. And even Al Gore, you know, with all of his environmental credentials, has done virtually nothing to see to it that was made an environmental good grief, what am I, my brain
Superfund?
Yeah, Superfund status site. He did essentially nothing. Even a declaration of disaster status, even which is far less than a Superfund site. Just a declaration of disaster site by the governor of Tennessee.
Well, if I may dare say, I think you found a home as far as radio is concerned, because this is something that has been much on our mind. We spent a lot of time on it, and in fact, we were. One of, if not the first, organization to break the real horror of the Kingston spill. If you go back to roughly the date when it happened, in our archives,
Christmas, yeah.
Yeah, in our archives at whiterosesociety.org, you will find a conversation that I think was about an hour or more in length with a man by the name of John Wathen, who is a dear friend of the show. He is the Hurricane Creek Keeper from down in Alabama. And he got busy and got up there, got aerial shots, got out on the river, and was the first person to document the ashbergs that were floating down the waterway. He was opposed and harassed by TVA police every step of the way, but he was absolutely undaunted and made sure that the information got out there and has continued to work on it. I don't know how much you followed it lately. But a lot of that ash has been put aboard train cars and sent to one of the poorest counties in Alabama to be dumped on the people who live there.
Oh, geez. No, I hadn't heard about that part. Yeah, they just, TVA, you know, to me, with these secret settlements and whatnot, it would seem to me that they should be looked at in, you know, some sort of a status as an organized crime organization. They keep using their top secret status, since they do so much with the Department of Energy, with the development of nuclear warheads and whatnot, that they have a sort of a top secret status. And that they're always able to skate from any responsibility because of their dealings or ongoing workings with the Department of Energy. So, yeah, absolutely. I think that there's, you know, I hate to get all conspiratorial in something as just simple as hazardous waste, but, you know, there's got to be some, I don't know if you have ever heard about Carthage, the famous old city that was destroyed by the Greeks, but Carthage was the first usage of hazardous waste as a military technique, and I actually caught Rush Limbaugh gleefully talking about the defeat of Gore in 2000 as we're going to treat Gore like the Carthaginians did. Gore, of course, came from a small town in Tennessee.
Called Carthage, Tennessee, yes, exactly.
Yeah.
And, it was the Romans under Scipio Africanus. Who are said to have salted the earth after the destruction of Carthage.
Right, yeah, they had beautiful topsoil up in there and great agricultural lands, and the Carthaginians were always able to fend off any enemies because they were able to hold up in a way that they had plenty of food and a lush lifestyle so that they couldn't be sieged out. And by plowing in salt, they were able to force them into a situation where they were dependent upon others for food. So,
exactly.
Yeah, so it's, you know, with that in mind, you know, whether or not there are people who are intentionally destroying sections of the country so that they can create shortages of food, you know, just to profiteer.
Or even not even destroying the land, you know, look what, and if you're into green things, I think this will probably have some resonance with you. Look at what happened to farmlands with the emphasis that was placed on ethanol. I don't know what your stance on it is, but most of the green folks that I run with see ethanol as a giant boondoggle.
A danger, because if you start creating gasoline out of corn, so to speak, you're going to starve half the world, since half the world depends upon the price of corn being reasonable.
Exactly, and the corn that was planted was this Monsanto Franken crop called number 2 field grade corn that is so-called Roundup ready, and you can boil it for a month of Sundays and you can't eat corn on the cob from number 2 field grade corn. It cannot be consumed by a human until such time as it has been complexly fractured into high fructose corn syrup or the processed by a highly hormonalized and antibioticized cow into meat. Of course, if you're in San Francisco, then I'm sure you're familiar with the brilliant work of Michael Pollan over at Berkeley. You know, he's the one who said in The Omnivore's Dilemma that basically the American diet consists of diesel fuel and number 2 field grade corn. Because it's one or the other is somehow is attached to everything that we consume.
Yeah, it makes hominy sound delicious.
Yeah, no kidding. You know, but you had with the boom in the ethanol market, you had farmers who had previously raised food grade corn transferring to this Roundup Ready nightmare that can't be consumed as such by a human being, and it even spread south of the border into Mexico, into places like what is it, Jalisco or Juarez? No, Jalisco, the ancient home of agave cultivation, where generations-old agave fields were plowed under in the name of replanting with number 2 field-grade corn, drove the price of tortilla and masa flour through the roof in Mexico, threatens the absolute cradle of corn cultivation in the entire world with the pollution by cross-contamination from these Franken seeds.
Yeah,
it's an amazing and frankly terrifying story.
Right. Yeah. Well, there are a few of those. Oh crap! Who was that old economist that thought that we should destroy half the population of the planet? It starts with a Z.
Are you talking about Malthus?
Malthusian, right. Yeah, there are still a few Malthusians around out there that they'll try to pin it on somebody else, but they're certainly into, you know, coming up with weapons like the neutron bomb, kill all the people and keep the ruins for them to play in. So, yeah, there's a real insanity to the management of the planet. And, I appreciate your talking about this because I still think that many of those secret settlements should be challenged. You know, this we out here in California, about 97 or so, tried to put together a referendum that was we actually got it through the assembly, but it never got actually onto the ballot. But it was a corporate three strikes referendum that we'd be able to, if a corporation had three different injuries to the public costing more than $1 million, that their corporate charter could be lifted. And, you know, obviously many of the major corporations in California today are constantly causing all sorts of far in excess of $1 million damages. As a matter of fact, Chevron, just here in Richmond, right across the bay from San Francisco, is threatening to leave if they don't have the right to pollute even more. And of course, they don't ever want to take responsibility for cleaning it up. So, you know, they're quite willing to take excessive profits, never clean up the hazardous wastes, and then threaten the community by taking their jobs and going somewhere else. You know, so it's a strong-armed sort of technique, which is entirely threatening to the common good, to have a huge player out here. That's why, actually, we've started coming up with an alternative currency out here. You know, with the death of Howard Zinn, we've created a zinnia, and so there are all sorts of different opportunities for time dollars out here called the zinnia.
Oh, neat.
Yeah. So it's a great little opportunity. I was lucky enough to get a nice artist to put together a nice version. And hey, by the way, do you do interviews on your show?
We do from time to time. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, if you're a great fan of you familiar with Last Gasp Comics?
Yes, I am. As a matter of fact.
Zap Comics, Ark Rum, and whatnot.
Yeah.
They're coming on their 40th anniversary. And, if you're interested in doing an interview with them, that'll be coming up on April 1st for their 40th
anniversary. Oh, wow. Do you happen to have a contact?
Yeah, sure do. If you've got an email, I can shoot over contact info, sure.
Yeah, you can reach me real easy, Bob Kincaid, BobKincaid,
okay,
at gmail.com.
All right, we'll do. It's on its way.
All right, great. Well, David, this has been a wonderful conversation. I hope you'll be back and share your ideas and your thoughts, because frankly, you sound like a natural for a new addition to the Horn family.
No trouble. Yeah, it's funny. I was over at White Rose today, and I was just kind of flipping through all of the shows up there, and a lot of them were canceled. But older ones. Liz Brown was an old favorite of mine back in St. Louis. But yours. I noticed that Horn is still on the air, so I thought I'd give it a listen.
Well, I'm awfully glad that you did, and we've been hanging on by the last tattered thread of an equally tattered shoestring for almost 6 years now, and you know, frankly, as far as full on attempts to create an entire liberal network, we're the last man standing. We're what's left.
Well, maybe with this zinnia, you could create an alternative economy, and then you won't have to compare yourself against these thieves. That's essentially what the problem is, you know, alternative radio is trying to compete against. It's funny, I used to sell advertising about 10 or 15 years ago. As a matter of fact, Jerry Brown had about 30 AM radio stations that he was covering before he went to Pacifica. And I was selling ads for him, and for a bunch of magazines and television stations. And one of the... when I started trying to get local ads in some of the local markets that Jerry was covering, I got their rate sheet so I could make sure that I held on to their basic price structure. And Rush Limbaugh was always the loss leader. You know, he was $25 a minute when everybody else was $200 a minute.
Right.
Nobody wanted to advertise on Rush Limbaugh's show. This was, you know, in the mid-90s when Newt Gingrich was strong, you know, and Rush was in his prime, as if he isn't in his prime now. And
well, it's before his addiction got the complete better of him.
Right, yeah. Right. And so even at his prime, he couldn't sell ads at $25 a minute. I'm not sure if you're familiar with Snapple. Snapple originally was Rush Limbaugh's exclusive account.
Yes.
And all of a sudden, people started boycotting Snapple, and they were about to collapse when they decided to renounce Rush and start going over to other advertisers. And once they dumped, did a public renunciation of Rush, Snapple started to come back. But they were right ready to collapse solely because they were tied exclusively to Rush. And every other advertiser, in fact, even do you remember Color of Change was working on
yes.
the ad for Glenn Beck, and they got 80 different sponsors to jump from Glenn Beck, including Procter & Gamble. And, of course,
well, and Glenn Beck has lost every single sponsor he had in the United Kingdom as well at this point.
Right, yeah, and here's the market forces for why he doesn't lose his show. You know, it's Nazi gold that's keeping him alive. You know, there's no other explanation. You know, that $9 billion that went missing, or $21 billion that went missing from Iraq, that's probably paying for Glenn Beck's show, because there's no other explanation for why this, you know, market force.
Well, there's a right, and you know, we've made that argument on a number of occasions, David, that the sheer accounting numbers will not support, for instance, you know, Rush is syndicated through Premier Radio Networks, right? And
yeah.
His contract was recently renewed to the tune of $40 million a year. Now,
yeah,
if you listen to one three-hour program, or if you really want to feel your brains just fall out the side of your head through your ears, listen to an entire week of three-hour programs. Write down every advertisement that runs in his program. Then try to figure out, and since you've got a background in advertising, figure out what that those national avails must cost, at least the ones that aren't per inquiry ads. And then extrapolate that over the course of a year and see if you can come up with $40 million for Rush and enough money to make Rush commercially viable for Premier Radio Networks.
That's what I'm saying.
And I submit to you that it is entirely impossible through any sort of honest accounting. And what I've argued all along is that there is the right wing is so far ahead of the curve as compared to liberals that it looks like straight road to us. And what I mean by saying that is all these foundations, all these think tanks, they get money from rich liberal donors that they are supposed to go out and spend. And they go out and they spend it on the likes of Rush. There's money quietly funneled to Rush, quietly funneled to Glenn Beck, that's not reported, that's strictly off the books, so to speak. You know, just like the way we ran the Iraq War under Bush, off the books.
Right. But you're saying it's coming from liberal organizations?
No. It's coming from the Heritage Foundation. It's coming from the Competitive Enterprise Institute, the American Enterprise Institute. All those right wing organizations and the left wing liberal organizations don't have a clue of how that works because Macy's doesn't tell Gimbel's.
Well, I still contend, that it's like Nazi gold. This stuff was stashed in the mountains someplace, and slowly but surely they've been bringing it out as the price gets higher. So, you know, they're essentially dealing with, you know, the artifacts stolen from the Baghdad Museum. They're selling off paintings from Goring. They're dealing with the teeth out of the gold of the disappeared from Argentina and Chile. This is Nazi gold that they're using to fund people like Beck and Rush Limbaugh. They've always, Phyllis Schlafly, for example, I still go to yard sales quite a bit. I remember back in the 70s I found a book, Pristine Shape. It's from Phyllis Schlafly, written about 1956 or so, and on the cover of it said 20 million copies sold. Now there's no way in the world that Phyllis Schlafly ever sold a book with 20 million copies. But it really speaks to the scandal that both Jim Wright and Newt Gingrich were doing. They had gotten a phony backer to essentially claim that 20 million copies were there. They didn't pay any taxes on them. They probably found some way to do a tax dodge on them. But they essentially just wrote it on the front cover and gave themselves some sort of an authority as if 20
Well, it's actually even simpler than that, David. If you ever look at the New York Times list of bestsellers, you know, they've got all those little symbols that sit outside beside the numbers. And there's one that's a little dagger or a little cross. It looks more like a dagger to me. And that means that the sales are inflated by bulk sales.
Right.
And if you ever go to World, Wingnut Daily or Free Republic or any of those nasty right-wing sites, you will find that they're offering, you know, get Sarah Palin's book free when you subscribe to Wingnut Daily.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
And what they do is they buy them by the case, and they warehouse them, and then they give them away.
Right. Yeah, well, that's the whole point, and that's what I was talking about with both Jim Wright and Newt Gingrich. If you hadn't kept, you know, Newt Gingrich essentially brought down Speaker of the House Jim Wright based upon a book deal identical to that. Jim Wright had gotten some wholesale backers to buy his autobiography. And then just a few years later, after Newt Gingrich was king of the Hill, it was discovered that he had done exactly the same thing, and his resignation was based on exactly the same thing. So, you know, it may sound like a funny little thing to do, but it's actually a tax dodge, and it's a fraud in a number of different realms. So, I understand that completely, and that's what I'm saying. You know, there weren't 20 million copies of Phyllis Schlafly's book ever printed. She, just like the producers, you know, they were hoping that they could have an instant failure after all of the different people piled on to be supporters. And, they've always played they've cheated their own supporters. And that's what's the most interesting thing about this. The fact that all of the Tea Party people have been dropping out like flies because they've realized that they've been cheated by the top leadership. You know, to charge $500 to attend a conference like they just had, when your average Tea Party member is supposed to be a poor person from out of the hills of Idaho or something like that, and they're going to ask them to pay $500 a ticket, you know, it's pretty obvious that they've been dropping out like flies, and yet the spin of the media is the Tea Party is as strong as ever. It is an inflated thing that they want a top-down leadership, and they'll take the enthusiasm of some old footage. But basically, those crowds haven't shown up in months, and they're still playing old footage and
even dummying up the footage on Fox. Absolutely.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. It's almost, you know, like with the book business, it's almost like they're counting, as you know, counting not real numbers. It's almost like some sort of book right wing book futures bubble,
if
you will.
Well, you know, they got to have some way to steal, you know, keep that Nazi gold and whatnot. So, yeah, they keep investing in their frauds. And where Democrats try to, you know, to balance the books in some authentic way, or Greens do in some authentic way, these old boys have never dealt in authentic ways. They've always dealt with stolen money and cooked books. So, you know, that's one of the major aspects of, the solutions to all of this is realizing that, you know, for example, Horn Radio, if you're trying to compare yourself against their fraudulent books, you're always going to fail. But if you, come up with local currencies and you come up with ways of marketing that actually give people a chance to interact. In fact, as you may know, if you're interested in food stuff, farmers markets are probably the fastest growing food distribution system in America at this point. People are very interested in supporting local farmers and supporting the local economy. Right wingers, left wingers,
buying subscriptions and shares.
Yeah.
In fact, we've got a listener up in Pennsylvania who's actively involved with one. And here locally, I try to when the growing season kicks in here in West Virginia, we've got one across the river that I try to go, you know, when the season's in to get my bell peppers, my cucumbers, and so forth.
Some way to advertise the farmers markets. you know, find some way to create a local, you know, stabilize the local economies in the various. For example, you know, I'm not sure how many affiliates you've got, and I don't really want to get sidetracked with that, but if back in the old days, before, you know, the media takeovers that Clinton authorized with the Telecom Act, when an economy got bad in the local, you know, whether it was a small market or even a regional market, you know, St. Louis or something like that, many of the radio stations, rather than demand cash for their advertising, for example, an auto dealership might put together a fleet of cars for the staff of the radio station.
Oh, I'm well familiar with it. I've worked in and around local radio for a long time. I know the glory of the trade-out deal.
Right, yeah, and so the radio station might get free food at restaurants. There might be a local grocery chain that would give, a certain amount of groceries to every staff employee. And it would be based upon a barter arrangement, and, you know, the electricity bill would be paid by those that could afford the cash, but for the most part, the staff would have to live on barter arrangements, but they'd get free gasoline from some station, or, you know, gas station. They'd get the use of the car. They'd get the free food from the grocery store. They might get free rent from a landlord or something like that. And for the most part, they could survive. But with the corporate chains owning so many radio stations, that essentially is illegal now because the corporate chain owns across state lines. It demands its amount of cash at the end of the quarter, and it can't abide these barter arrangements. The barter arrangements were the ways that local economies could survive. So if you were to figure out some sort of a way of doing an ad campaign that was to be tailored toward the sustainable economy and something that couldn't be stolen by the corporations. I'm sure it can be done, and you know it's something that Horn could do a huge amount of support for the local.
Yeah, it's just a matter of building
it.
Well, of creating it and building the staff to do it with.
Sure.
Yeah, because everybody here is working on a volunteer basis. Let me backtrack you for just a minute, David, before we wind up. I got an email in from our dear friend Jude up in the Great Northwest, and she asked me to bring to your attention, since you did mention the Kingston ash spill and so forth, she asked me to bring to your attention a website that might just sort of blow your mind. It's called Carl, C-A-R-L, Gailey, G-A-L-I-E, photography.com, Carl Gailey, photography.com. And what he has done is document the horror of mountaintop removal here in West Virginia, where we are.
Oh, sure, yeah.
And you'll see things that are absolutely mind-boggling there, like photos of the Brushy Fork impoundment, the largest dam in the Western Hemisphere that holds back 9.8 billion gallons of toxic waste that, when it breaks, will send a wave 60 feet high for virtually 100 miles.
Right, yeah,
of toxic waste. Yeah.
I'm very familiar with it. As a matter of fact, out here, I've been working with Greenpeace on the clean coal scam, and I've been trying to find some documentation. Back in the 80s, if I recall, before the Soviet Union fell, there was a massive hazardous waste spill that went through, and I'm trying to think if in the if it was the Po River. It was the Ukraine is there. Best agricultural land in the former Soviet Union, and the if I remember right, the Po River runs through there, and they had an industrial salts dam that was also an equal amount of millions of gallons of these industrial salts, and that dam collapsed, and if I recall, it blew out 8 or 9 other dams, and it went far further than 100 miles. It essentially was one of those, you know, there was Chernobyl, and there was that industrial salt dam collapse that essentially helped bring down the Soviet Union. And it's, you know, Ronald Reagan tries to, you know, lay claim to it, but that dam collapse was an enormous one that laid waste to much of the river that runs. It would be the equivalent of the Missouri River here in, you know, in the upper Midwest. And, you know, just blowing out. I've been calling a lot of radio stations from Montana all the way down to New Orleans, warning them about the so-called clean coal, because, you know, if they get started with that up in Montana, as they're trying to do, they're going to end up putting these vast hazardous waste dams just waiting to bust open, and then it would just devastate the Missouri River, which is the agricultural heartlands of America. And as well, out in Grand Junction, Colorado, a little upstream of there in a place called Parachute, Colorado, they were also working on a shale oil project, which is the equivalent of clean coal. And they would end up also, it's a 20-to-1 ratio of hazardous waste for every gallon produced. So in other words, if they create 1 gallon of this shale oil gasoline, they'd have 20 gallons of highly polluted water. And they can't spare 20-to-1 ratio of water in the West anyway, much less that they would make a dam that would just be a sort of Damocles waiting over the agricultural river of the Colorado, which runs through Grand Junction's Grand Valley, which is a big agricultural valley, then down through Arizona's agriculture and through Southern California's agricultural section.
So water is clearly the issue. That confronts us in the 21st century. A lot of people say, well, you know, we fight wars for oil. Eventually, the wars we fought over oil, if things continue apace, David, the wars that we fought over oil will be chicken feed compared to the wars that we fight over water.
Oh, I know. Yeah,
and it'll be a hell of our own making, too.
Sure. So I call up gardening shows on the weekends telling them to plant more trees. And for the most part, people are into it. You know, they see that we've got to, if we're going to be unemployed, we should be out there doing the Johnny Appleseed trip. But we've got to make sure that these lands that these corporate, monsters are owning are asset seized. So, for example, with the corporate three strikes that I was just talking about, typically the corporate seizure of its business license, its corporate charter, you seize its property in compensation for the damages. So if Chevron has created $10 billion worth of damages in the Bay Area here and their plant is only worth $2 billion, we seize that and try to get as much cash as we can also. So, asset forfeiture is what we've got to do to these corporations and then get out there and replant on these vast lands that they hold and never use or, you know, they abuse. So,
That makes so much sense to me, David, because Massey Energy, who was one of the worst, is the worst practitioner of mountaintop removal here in central Appalachia, was busted, stone cold busted, criminal action, not civil.
Right.
For literally billions of dollars worth of violations. The Bush administration negotiated a plea bargain with Massey, of course, in which no one goes to jail. And Massey was then, assessed an absolute de minimis fine, absolutely chicken feed to them. In another instance, the state of West Virginia negotiated a settlement. And the monies that were due to be paid to the state of West Virginia were allowed to be paid. And I know this may sound mind-boggling, but the state of West Virginia accepted payment. The mountain state, we got mountains, we got lots of rocks. The state of West Virginia accepted payment in rocks, like an episode of the Flintstones. I wish I was joking.
No kind of specific minerals?
Just rock.
What, for their highways or what?
For whatever use the state of West Virginia has for rock.
Did that hit the headlines out there?
It was deliberately kept under the radar, but it's very much real.
Yeah, well, that's one of those things that, in an election year, I work on a lot of different, I stream radio stations all the time, and West Virginia's got a few different people that might be more than interested in hearing about that, even if it takes, calling a Cincinnati station to get them informed. It'll always make an impact in their elections. And, good grief, who was I talking to the other day? Oh, yeah, Ward Churchill. I was talking to him the other day. He's still going through his problems with the losing his tenure out in Colorado. And apparently they elect their board of regents for the school district or the university system out there. Here in California, the governor appoints the board of regents, but at least in Colorado, they get to elect their regents. Well, in the case of West Virginia, like you're talking about, the judges, I'm not sure if they're elected or they have to stand for re-election every...
we elect all our judges and magistrates.
Sure. So, yeah, absolutely. Put that name out there. What was that judge's name? Why did he sign on to such a horrible ruling? I mean, a guy like that is essentially, you know, it's corporate welfare. And, you know, welfare for mass murderers, essentially. I'm not sure what the nature of, well, the mountaintop removal, that you could probably do a dollar value of, you know, how much, you know, that damages the water system and causes...
Oh, it's been done. West Virginians pay $5 for every dollar that coal brings into this state.
Right, yeah, and with those kind of ratios, but in other words, health loss, you know, if it that amount of dust kicked up is going to give respiratory damages. And, for example, when I was young, I heard Frank Lloyd Wright give a speech about the building of a skyscraper, and I think for the first 17 floors you would lose two people, and then for each additional 11 floors you would lose another person. So each architect was really responsible for the deaths of a number of people, the more the higher the skyscraper was built. And so they had to take some responsibility for their architectural damages. And so the same has to be held true for the architects who are putting together you know, mountaintop removal. If they know tangibly that it's going to kill so many people, it's going to devastate the aquifer, it's going to...
David, the whys and wherefores of this whole process here in West Virginia is probably a solid week of three-hour programs. Suffice to say that we are inundated with political corruption. The coal industry owns our government, owns our judicial system, owns the media, owns our butts. And
yeah, I get that impression for Tennessee as well. The TVA, no one would fight the TVA. I must have called, you know, 40 radio stations in and around Tennessee, as well as all sorts of local governmental people, and nobody had the courage, whether it was Al Gore or the governor's office or the, you know, the various forms of the EPA. Everybody was terrified of the TVA. I finally got somebody to actually mention that, you know, in just in a kind of a whisper, that they, you know, there was general tendency of the TVA to be like the thugs that'll come in and kill your dog in your front yard and then, you know, your children too if you continued. So,
oh, the TVA,
you know,
is very much a sacred cow. Hey, David, I hate to cut it short, but we are
at the end of
the program.
Good week. Yeah, I'll call again.
All right. I hope you do. Take care.
Thanks again.
Bye now. Love hearing from new callers, new listeners, and you can see it's very easy. If you've never called the program, you know what? You can try next time we're on the air, which will be tomorrow night, which will be prayer meeting Wednesday. You know, with Bruce Hammond called the program a little bit ago, I wanted to provide a little bit of retrospective, and John Fox kindly sent these two old promos along. I thought you might get a kick out of them before we get out of here. This goes all the way back to the days of Fourth Estate Radio, and it is a precious, precious moment. Just so you can hear where the horn has been and where perhaps someday again the horn will go. There's great stuff going on here now, and it has been an amazingly creative effort from the very first, from the very beginnings. So just an old Fourth Estate promo, just for you to hear the sort of fun we have had then and now.
On the last Fourth Estate, we heard from Robert Fisk.
What has now become a habit of compromising on the semantics of reporting in order to avoid criticism. You know, if you call a Jewish settlement or neighborhood a colony, you'll be criticized and called potentially anti-Semitic.
And a little bit of activist history and the Red Scare.
On the line with us right now, we have Kate Fossil, biographer of Ann Braden.
You know, I got interested in Ann's life because of her being a white Southern voice against racism. And
leave it to our listeners to ring up and keep it light.
I don't either. And, you know, Bruce is concerned about the remote control for his DVD player. I mean, I'm thinking about getting rid of the remote control on my blow-up doll. I mean, you know.
What's his name?
I never kiss a doll.
WithEstateRadio.com.
Yeah, and then there was this. This may be the classic of all classics.
Hey, listen, tell me something, John. Do you guys eat a lot of mangoes down there?
Not enough to base a foreign policy on.
Well, I'm going to tell you something. We don't eat that many of them here either.
The United States is India's largest trading partner.
and India is one of the United States' fastest growing export markets. Oh, by the way, Mr. Prime Minister, the United States is looking forward to eating Indian mangoes.
That's right. It's March Mango Madness. Nukes for mangoes, mangoes for nukes. Join Bruce and I, John Fox, this weekend, Saturday night, 10 p.m. Eastern Time on the Head On Radio Network. Catch us at 4thEstateRadio.com or HeadOnRadioNetwork.com.
Oh, what a time that was. Fourth Estate Radio is gone, but not forgotten. Yeah, mangoes for nukes, nukes for mangoes. And it's time for us to get out of here. Another gentle reminder, we need all the help we can get at the PayPal button at headonradionetwork.com under the tab Contribute. There's also a snail mail address there that you can use. Thanks go out, as ever, to everybody who makes all of this happen, starting with you yourself, as well as our news ninjas, Gene and Susan, our blogger Texas Betsy, Sue, Lottie, moderators in the chat room, and Sue, co-webmistress of the blog and the video producer extraordinaire, to John Fox, to Peter Godbold, who you heard in that promo, to Ben Birch at WhiteRoseSociety.org. Also to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the folks at Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net, and coalriverwind.org. They are, in fact, the hardest working, bravest people I know. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you.